stain. This pain is a wages of rock. Hood spread, you know I keep my hair on the cross. Going free, seven women repping the block. Ain't so straight, I gotta shoot the mile on the rock. Collar popping cause it just don't stop. When I
lay back in it, join the
lose the bad guys, hit a fence. Better call insurance. 1-800-ESURANCE. Hi, Agent Aaron here. I've gotten into a fender bender eluding my pursuers. Don't worry, I wasn't injured.
Well, Special Agent, look on the bright side. At least you've got Esurance.
True, with Esurance, I can report a claim anytime, 24-7, 365 days a year.
And don't forget, at Esurance, there's always someone there to help.
With Esurance's fast, friendly claims representatives, I'll be back on the road in no time.
That's right, Special Agent. Affordable rates, fast, friendly service, round-the-clock claims handling. That's Esurance.
And that's why I always say, if you're on the go, you've got to have Esurance.
Save on 24-7 claim service at Esurance. Get your auto insurance quote at Esurance.com today.
Are you looking for a unique tattoo to set you apart from the crowd? Well, Inkslingers offers one-of-a-kind artistic designs you won't find anywhere else. There has never been a more perfect time to have that tattoo you always wanted. Inkslingers offers same-day service and walk-ins are always welcome. Inkslingers has tattooed nearly 500,000 Metro Detroiters and continues to lead the market with their exclusive designs. Their proven safety system is second to none. Call 1-888-TATTOOS and get that tattoo you've been dreaming of. Inkslingers offers a professional, clean environment with several studios to serve you. Inkslingers headquarters has moved from 12 in Cratchit to south of 9 on Cratchit. Visit Inkslingers in Dearborn Heights, Sterling Heights, Centerline, or East Point. What are you waiting for? Come in and get that tattoo you've been dreaming of and learn how you can get your next tattoo free. This offer is good for a limited time only. Call 1-888-TATTOOS for more information. That's 1-888-TATTOOS. Inkslingers, offering professional, friendly service for more than 15 years.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Tita Size in Garden City, a Filipino restaurant that offers delicious Filipino food. All of their dishes are sure to leave a wonderful taste in your mouth. The only problem is choosing which one. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer. Before they hit it big, Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10, it's loud, it's local, and no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Playing the station that supports local rock. 101 WRIF. Riff. You're listening to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Well, let's see. We are starting a little late, aren't we? About 5 minutes late, so we'll get right into it. Please give us a call at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. And we are broadcasting mainly, well, I don't know. We really can't figure that out. How many of you are listening on the internet all across the country and all across the world? I know lots of you are. I get letters, email messages from you all the time at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's good during the program as well. If you want to make some comments about what I'm saying or what you'd like to say or comments on what other people say, short messages are best. If you write a manifesto, I'll try to read it tomorrow, but no way in the world can I get it on. You know, I always start with this technical stuff, and it's growing because the technology is such that before all this the computer stuff happened, it was just, there's the phone number. Everybody was just listening in the Michigan, Ohio, Ontario region. That was it. But now we are, you know, that ZZ Top song, I'm bad, I'm nationwide. Well, yeah, when you're broadcasting, you're bad, you're international. Anyway, a lot of other places you can go on the internet for rebroadcast of this program tomorrow at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Everything I say is Eastern time here in the United States. You can go to radiopower.org. Radiopower.org is also streaming this along with WRIF.com. And then it's all archived at whiterosesociety.org. And you go to my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. You say, all right, that takes care of all the technical stuff. No, well, it grows and grows and grows. We don't have it going yet, but we're going to be podcasting. That's right, podcasting. You know, those iPods, and you're going to be able to download this program directly from the WRIF site and onto your iPod. And if you're wondering what an iPod is, you're not ready to do it. That's okay, because we're here live, and then you can go to these all these other places and hear the show and download the show and all that. Also, if you we're now broadcasting in HD radio. And again, if you don't know what that is, that maybe you should find out. That's definitely is the wave of the future, but you need a receiver for that. One of the things you can get on there is RIF 2. If you go to WRIF.com, you can, it's a great sort of parallel WRIF, or not even W, parallel RIF, let's say. And a lot of great music, hardcore, indie rock, hip-hop, industrial, alternative, that kind of stuff. So that's there. And let's see, is that it? Yeah, all right, that's all the technical stuff. Hi, Jay Hudson is our producer and our phone screener, and probably he'll pick up the calls that are ringing now, so patience, please, he'll get to those. And Jay will be broadcasting the Riff Rock at 2 a.m. tonight, so he'll be doing this show. And he's also, of course, the co-host of Motor City Riff, so the man gets a lot of work here. Well, we're coming up. I mean, well, I don't even know what day it is now. So this is the 31st, so is it Saturday? I guess it is, August 6th. It's the 60th anniversary of the United States dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Then 3 days later, they dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. And, I don't know, we talk about, if you've followed the show for a long time, usually at this time each year, I talk about this because this is one of these aspects of American history that people just accept or sort of take for granted. So when I say there was absolutely no military need, absolutely no military need whatsoever to drop the bomb on either city, people immediately kind of go, wait, no, that's not true. That's what ended the war. And if we hadn't have dropped the bomb, what would have happened? I don't care whether you're 80 years old or 14. Actually, let me see. The youngest person has ever written me at calltalkyes at yahoo.com is 13. Whether you're 13 or 83, probably, unless you know about this stuff, the first thing that comes to your mind is, if we hadn't have done this, we would have had a million casualties. Right? Isn't that it? Isn't that the story? And you never really stop to think, would that have really happened? Would an invasion of Japan ever been necessary in order to make them surrender? And if it wasn't a military necessity, why in the world would the United States have done this? Well, whether it was justified or not, it let the genie out of the bottle. And our greatest fear, as Americans and other people in the Western world, is that some terrorist will get a hold of a weapon, will get a hold of atomic weapon or atomic material, and blow off a bomb in some populated city for any perverse reason. I mean, that attack on the civilians. And they, I'm sure, just like every nation justifies its attacks on civilians, they'll be able to justify theirs because of, I don't even have to go into it, fill in the blanks. It depends on what side you're in, right? Then it's okay to kill civilians. You're doing it because, well, something like during World War II, something like, what was it, 30 million civilians, or maybe that's all together, military and civilians, but it was about 90% civilians. And the United States, along with all the other countries, added to it by bombing civilian centers, of which Hiroshima was one and Nagasaki was one. Real limited military value. For all practical purposes, by July of 1945, Japan was defeated. And it was just a matter of how they would surrender. And I would say, along, and I didn't make this up, I'm not so smart, I had to read history in order to figure this out, is that the American historians that they call revisionists, that is, they're revising the official versions of American history, say that it was almost exclusively a political decision. Partly it was driven by the fact that the United States possessed it. And the old adage that Napoleon used to say that the only thing you cannot do with bayonets is sit on them. In other words, you have them, you use it. An extraordinary amount of money was spent to develop the atomic weapon during the Manhattan Project and all of what went on in New York and then with its testing in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and what have you. But and there was I mean, these people were they're worrisome in many ways, because at the time in 1945, before they exploded it, they weren't sure what was going to happen. There was a section of the atomic scientists who thought there was a possibility that if the United States exploded an atomic weapon, that it could trigger an ignition of the atmosphere. All right, if you want to call during any of this, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And, but they went ahead with it. They, well, what the hell, you know? We got to take a few chances here, right? And this is after, or about the same time. I'm doing this all from memory, but I'm pretty confident of what I'm saying. This is after Germany had surrendered, and the United States essentially was chasing Japanese troops back to their homeland. Some of the conventional bombings, like the bombing of Tokyo, took enormous civilian casualties. Again, not really even carrying out any military purpose. Let me go at this sequentially. So, political reasons. To make sure that Japan surrendered to the United States and not the Soviet Union, who had come into the war, or was about to come into the war. And the United States was fearful that there was a possibility that that the Japanese government, the defeated Japanese government, thought they could get a better deal with the Soviets than they did with the United States. Secondly, it was a shot across the bow of the Soviet Union. It was to say, we now possess the most deadly weapon in the history of humankind. Not only do we have it, but we'll use it. So don't mess with us. In many ways, it didn't have that kind of effect that Stalin did what he did. Pretty much took over Eastern Europe, and it wasn't the kind of tactical weapon that could be used. But as I said, the genie was out of the bottle, and now we face the possibility of having this come back to us, blow back in the worst possible manner. Because subsequently to that, this technology, which then began to be increasingly available, it's not that secret. I have a book called How to Make an Atom Bomb, and it gives you the entire manner in which you could make it. I mean, you got to have the fissionable material, and you got to have laboratories and what have you. But then you have to have a delivery system. That's why, for instance, Mexico or Liechtenstein or something like that doesn't have one. I mean, they don't want one anyways, but they couldn't deliver it. But if you have madmen so driven by rage or by religion or, you know, real or imagined abuses and grievances, willing to sacrifice their own lives, well, ethically, what differentiates them from our attack on the citizens, the unarmed citizens of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? You know, we say we're at war with them. They say they're at war with us. You know, what the hell? You know, you use what you can in wars, right? But you have to look at the dangers that still that atomic warfare represents in our world. And remember last week I was seeing that poll that isn't it over 60% of Americans think we'll see World War III in our lifetime? Who are we going to be fighting? I mean, the only possible power imaginable, unless things change dramatically in the next few years, would be China. And they're an atomic power. So why wouldn't, for instance, given the opportunity, wouldn't the Bush administration, since we're the most powerful of the nuclear powers, begin to ramp this all down? It could be because, you know, Bush can't pronounce it. He says, what does he say, nuclear or something like that. But in any event, the nutballs that populate this White House, that do not realize the inherent danger in so many different people, that's a real fear, people, but so many different governments possessing nuclear technology and not wanting to de-escalate, to have as a goal, to say our goal is a complete elimination of nuclear weapons, total nuclear disarmament for the entire world. That's not a goal. Instead, Bush is trying to promote another generation of nuclear weapons, all this bunker buster stuff, wants to get rid of these bans and underground testing and all of that. This is extraordinarily dangerous. We're going to be lucky if we get out of our lives without there being a nuclear explosion, another attack on civilians. Because, I mean, they have battlefield nukes and all that, but there ain't no battlefields anymore. Right? I mean, where are you going to use it? I mean, for one thing, say the Gulf One, where there actually was some traditional positional warfare. But you start blowing these bombs off, and this cloud of nuclear fallout begins to drop where? Everywhere in the Middle East. So you can't use it. I mean, they're almost unusable. All right, your thoughts on that. I'm Peter Werbe. This is the Night Call Show. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. That's 298-9743. Oh, yeah. Go to my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. Go to the calendar section over on the left. There's going to be an anti-nuclear weapons rally in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where a lot of weaponry facilities are. And you want to be part of that effort, go down there. The information there will tell you the people that are taking buses. All right. Now, I don't know, maybe I was going to read this letter, but maybe this speaks to it. One of the things that's really important in radio for broadcasters is that you don't listen to one person. And it's also, we are really glad when we're playing rock and roll, or certainly when we're doing the show, to get phone calls. But you can't allow like one person to drive your programming, because usually what you get as a DJ, which I've done for years, is people say, oh, man, you're the greatest. You know, I love what you're playing. Well, ultimately, you got to see what's the aggregate ratings. So even if we get good phone and your ratings are low, that doesn't mean much. And similarly, sometimes you get negative calls. You suck, man. Your station sucks. You suck. And during the 80s, when really stations were pretty immature, one station would get someone to call a DJ. They would get some, like, intern to call up some DJ. So they would call, like, on our station, Arthur Penn Island, and say, you're terrible, man. You stumbled over that word. You suck. Everyone's laughing at you. And it's odd. That actually, I mean, I've heard it a lot, so it doesn't really bother me. But it kind of gets you, because maybe it's all of our kind of thin egos or something like that, that oftentimes we hear the criticism. We hear the criticism, we hear the negative calls more than like 10 compliments. You get one negative, you get 50 compliments, and you go, like that. I don't do that. But anyway, but here, AJ writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, what sort of show is this? You know, I just don't get it. Every time I tune into your show, you're railing on the Bush administration. Don't you talk about anything else? Well, I just did, although I added a little bit of Bush stuff. I never seem to hear anything about our community here in Detroit. This is an excellent point, AJ. At some point, not going to read this, but he says, sorry if I sound harsh, but that's cool. The complaint department, pardon me, is always open. Just tell me, is your show supposed to be just political? We have a lot of issues here in Detroit that we can discuss. Well, two things that occur to me. And if you've listened to the beginning of shows, I always say, I have this huge pile of stuff about the economy. And I do tonight as well. In fact, it's left over from last week, so it's twice as large. But given the fact that we're in this war, given the fact of that the Bush administration continues on this far right-wing agenda to alter significantly the nature of this country, it doesn't seem to me that I can talk about too much else, although the economy is certainly part of it. Now, that said, that's my view, okay? But AJ and the rest of you that don't want to hear about Bush and how the war is wrong and how we should immediately withdraw and all that, you have the option of going to the phone, calling 313-298-WRIF, and say, I want to talk about Detroit. Or if you're listening in Chicago or Baton Rouge or something like that, I want to tell you what's happening around here and the significance that it has. So don't put it all off on me. This is our show. And you know, this isn't just kind of host BS because I don't have a phone screener, Jay Hudson, that's going to say, oh, you want to talk about something other than the war in Iraq? I'm not letting you on. If you call up and you say, I want to talk about what's happening to our city, our region, what have you, you're there. You're on. All right? So if you want to talk about other things, it's your show as well as mine. I've got my little hobby horses, ones which I think are not really hobby horses, but extraordinarily important. If you don't think they're as important as I do, and you have other topics you want to bring up, please do. 313-298-WRIF. All right, one other thing, and then we'll get to the phones. That is that the shuttle Discovery may need repairs in space. Apparently, there's a couple of short strips of fabric dangling from the belly of the Discovery and may require something that's never happened before. Spacewalking on the underside. It would, in fact, it's the first in 24 years of shuttle flight, and they've never ventured beneath their spacecraft in orbit. And actually have made very few repairs to their ship, certainly none of this magnitude. So we're all, whatever you're doing, crossing your fingers or praying or hoping or whatever we can do, send out good vibes, you know, let's do it. I think I've told you this before, I do all of this from memory. I don't have a team of producers that are putting stuff up on the screen, so I sound smart. If I sound smart or dumb, it's all out of my head. And I guess usually it's like your political view. If you don't agree with me, you think I'm dumb as a stump. If you agree with me, you tend to think I'm smarter than that. Anyways, last week I said there had been 50 shuttle flights and two accidents, making the odds 1 in 25. And I'm surprised no one caught that. Actually, I looked this up. And sometimes I say things and I go, am I right? So it was 113 flights and two accidents. But, you know, I wouldn't go up in one of these things. These things are, it's like a beater. You know, I don't know if everyone uses that phrase. It's kind of a Detroit phrase. A beater is an old car like with 100,000 miles on it, you know, really. Maybe a Toyota or something like that can take it. But an American car with 100,000 miles on it, all kind of, you know, bumped up and all that. We call them beaters. And essentially, isn't sort of the Discovery a beater? It's got like 100 million miles on it. It's built in the 70s. It has, and I didn't realize this, it has 1.25 million parts. And you don't have much room for error on this. So, good luck to them, is what I say. All right, a lot to chew on. You may have some things as well. Let's go to Keith in Clinton Township. Keith, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, what's going on, Peter? First of all, I want to say I love your show.
Well, thank you.
And in all honesty, I always agree with what you have to say, especially on the Bush administration. I didn't vote for the guy. But if you don't want me backtracking about the Japan thing about Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
sure,
that is a very dark period of American history, I will admit that. But the sad thing is, I think we had to do that because Hiroshima and Nagasaki were two very vital installations when it came to Japan's war machine, if you will, and with the million-strong casualties they could have inflicted on us, that is true because the people of Japan, they believe the emperor to be basically God, and they followed the way of the samurai, Bushido. And really, the emperor said every man, woman, child literally will pick up sticks or whatever and use them against us.
Well,
and it would have just been a complete massacre. But
well, it, you know, it doesn't make it so by saying it. I mean, first off, the million casualty, no one, I mean, I think like Truman or somebody said that. But actual real military estimates, even if the United States would have had to have launched a full-scale invasion, I mean, that's insane. There would never have been a million casualties. For one thing, the United States wouldn't even have had that many troops to deploy there. Secondly, the idea that they would have fought to the death was in part, if they would have at all, was engendered by the United States' demand for unconditional surrender, which many people think extended the war, because the Soviet Union first, and then finally the United States said, okay, it's not unconditional surrender. In fact, the emperor will be retained. And that was really a sticking point. Secondly, people, everybody from Curtis LeMay, who did all this saturation bombing of Tokyo and all that, said that there was no need for atomic weapons, that he could have conventionally bombed the Japan into submission. The head of submarine warfare said all they had to do was quarantine the island. Remember that Japan was not was importing foodstuff, was importing oil. The army was essentially defeated. It was stranded all across the Pacific, all across Asia, and what have you. So I'm sorry to say this like this, Keith, but you really have to look a little deeper into this. The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey said that Japan, if without an invasion, without even continuing bombing, would have surrendered by November.
Hmm.
I mean, I'll tell you, for starters, look go look at Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States, or Gar Alperovitz. Alperowitz, or just put in, go to Google, put in decision, bomb, Hiroshima. Finally, they were, I mean, and this, we can't argue about facts on this. My contention is that, and from what I've read, is that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were targets of opportunity, and they were picked solely because of the weather. All right, check it out. Let me know if what you think. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Matt and Warren. Matt, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Hey, Matt.
Yeah, I'm from Warren.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. All right. I just had a comment and then a question.
Sure.
My comment was Japan. I've gotten this from fairly legitimate sources, according to me, so I'm not just up here spewing out propaganda or anything, but according to these sources, Japan had been ready to surrender since February 1945. The one sticking point, as you kind of hinted on earlier, was whether they could keep the emperor or not.
Right.
And I don't know if that was just kind of BS or not, but
no, that's true.
You figure, like, not only, I mean, we kind of owe this to the people who died on Okinawa and even Iwo Jima, like our own American soldiers, as, like, did they even need to go take those islands to begin with? And you really have to wonder, like, when you hear stuff like from Einstein, as well as from Eisenhower and Nimitz, who all, like, in the end, they said we did not have to bomb Japan like that. Einstein said it was that letter he wrote to Roosevelt was his greatest mistake in his career.
Yeah, actually, Einstein, whose theories led to the atomic bomb, he had a quote that said, "If I would have known, I would have been a shoemaker, I think, or I would have been a carpenter."
Yeah, and it's just amazing. I'm 100% with you on this, that we do not have to drop the atomic bombs. And
well, let me just add one little wrinkle to it. The hatred for Japan, understandably, during that era, because of their initiating the war with this unwarranted sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, people were delighted. People were absolutely delighted. In fact, all during World War II, like, for instance, when the British, the RAF, began these, what they called terror bombings. That was what newspapers in Britain would say. Successful terror bombing of Hamburg or Dresden or something like that. And the fact that the Germans and were suffering these horrendous civilian casualties was extraordinarily pleasing to the people of England. And one understands that fully. But that's not what we're talking about. I mean, paybacks, as they say in Detroit, I can't say what they are, but paybacks are MFs. So you could almost shuffle it off like that. But the fact that all sides carried out indiscriminate killings of civilians make it, in many ways, a terrible horror show.
Yeah, and you figure about the sticking point with the emperor. The sad part is, like, Japan kept their emperor. Like, ultimately, we said, you know, even after the atomic bombs, it's not worth it. You know, let him have the emperor, and he's still there.
But see, the deal is that what was decided at Yalta or Potsdam, one of these conferences was Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt, I can't remember which one, it was agreed that the Soviet Union would declare war on Japan. Which it hadn't, 3 months after victory in Europe, VE Day, which came in, what, April? Or
it was May 8th.
May 8th, okay. So what date would they have declared war on Japan? August.
I'm not sure exactly when they...
August 8th. In other words, August 8th. And there was already talk within the Tojo government... the prime minister or something like that, to surrender to the Soviet Union because they thought they could get a better terms of surrender. Like, for instance, when Einstein and others said that they ought to have a non-military display, or what would you call it, exhibition of the atomic weapon out in the Pacific to show the Japanese leaders, say, look, this is what we got and this is what we can do.
Yeah, I just had a quick question too. Like, I'm trained to be an educator, like a high school teacher, and I want to teach this view of the atomic bomb droppings. But I know, and I mean, there's going to be a lot of parents that are going to get ruffled, you know, if their kids. And I don't want to get labeled as some wacky teacher. Like, I know you're not like a total authority on this or anything, but like, how would you like? What do you think would be the best way to introduce like this theory about American history?
Well, yeah.
This perspective without getting you know, written up by parents and such.
Well, I think that since there are two views on it, and it's still historically argued, this view of the revisionists, which includes Howard Zinn, which includes Gar Alperovitz, or Witz, I can't remember which, is refuted by other historians. So one could introduce both views. And see, you figure, which one makes more sense? I mean, when you start looking at all the historical data, which one comes out to be more sensible? I mean, where did the figure about a million casualties come from? Where did the idea that that was the only way, where did that come from? And and look then, because when I read this alternate theory of why the U.S. dropped the atomic weapons, it was like a light bulb going off. Like, whoa, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, that's what happened to me.
All right, Matt, thank you very much. I got to roll on and do a little business. Right back to get your calls. I don't think we're going to listen to AJ completely and not talk at all about this continuing quagmire in Iraq, almost up to 1,800 American casualties, just about to hit the 2,000 mark for coalition soldiers. But we'll talk about the economy as well and how voters apparently are deeply disillusioned with the national economy. If you're on the line, you want to continue talking about this subject or anything else that said you want to, stay tuned.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
So what's going on in the House that Rock built, David?
Whoa, excuse me?
What's happening at Rock Financial?
Oh, the newest, the latest and great. I got a doozy for you.
Real? A doozy?
I love the word doozy.
Okay, Beaver Cleaver.
Quick and easy. No pay stubs, no W-2s, no tax returns. A lot of folks have asked me about this. It's not a new one. It's an oldie but a goodie. Here's the deal. If you maybe are paid on commission, you're self-employed, you're in between jobs, there are so many factors of why you would want to use the Quick and Easy loan. And the interest rate on our Quick and Easy loan is extremely close to market rates. It's not 2 or 3% higher. We're talking right there, right there.
So you don't slam the door on people just because they aren't conventional.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Help everybody?
She could have done it in 5 seconds. It took me 60.
Well, you can call the Rock Financial experts, and they'll fill in the rest.
Right.
800-333-ROCK. They're home of the mortgage experts, and you can visit them online at rockfinancial.com. Rock Financial, a Quick and Loans Company, equal housing lender. Call today, 800-333-ROCK.
It's a doozy, the Quick and Easy. It's
doozy.
A doozy.
You doozy.
Doozy.
Another WRIF concert. America's favorite rock band is back.
You love me, but you don't know.
Bud Light presents Three Doors Down. Headlining an all-star summer concert with Stained. Breaking Benjamin. And Noah Dress. This Tuesday night at DTE Energy Music Theater. Three Doors Down with Stained, Breaking Benjamin, and Noah Dress. Tickets are available now on sale at PalaceNet.com, the Palace and DTE Energy Music Theater box offices and Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666 this Tuesday night at DTE Energy Music Theater. Three Doors Down with Stained, Breaking Benjamin, and Noah Dress. The rock ticket of the summer.
Tom?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Photocopying.
And sweating.
Oh, yeah. I'm working out.
Yeah.
It's easy, too. I can walk in place, jog in place, no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah, I know. But why are you?
I'm taking steps to a healthier lifestyle by incorporating steps into my everyday activities. Don't touch that.
Sorry. Now what are you doing?
Collating.
And deep knee bends.
Yeah, and I speed up here, too.
Uh-huh.
I learned it at MichiganStepsUp.org. You should take a look. Oh, hand me that towel.
Here you go.
You know, Michigan was rated one of the most out-of-shape states in the country.
Really?
MichiganStepsUp.org is the two-step program to losing that title, my friend.
Steps?
Move more, eat better.
It's that easy.
Hi, Tom.
Oh, hey, Tina.
Looking good. How about a walk at lunch?
Sure.
So, what was that website again?
MichiganStepsUp.org. Move more, eat better. Repeat. A message from the Michigan Department of Community Health, the Office of the Surgeon General, and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
Another WRIF concert.
This is a Detroit News Alert.
We're here with rock star Sammy Hagar, who's coming back to Detroit. Sammy, you just recently sold out the Fox Theater. Why are you coming back?
Hey, man! The tequila made me do it!
Wubba Wubba presents Sammy Hagar and the Wubbos.
Detroit, we are back!
Plus special guest, Montrose. We're back here with Sammy Hagar. Sammy, ticket prices all over the country are almost $200. Now, how can you sell tickets as low as $10?
The tequila made me do it!
This Saturday night at DTE Energy Music Theater. Get tickets now at PalaceNet.com, the Palace and DTE Energy Music Theater box offices and all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge by phone 248-645-6666. For VIP ticket packages and more info, visit RedRocker.com. Don't miss Sammy Hagar and the Wubbos. Presented by Miller Genuine Draft Live. Real music, real flavor.
It's back. Bigger and better than ever.
101 WRIF and Motor City Golf Warehouse in Novi present the 7th Annual Arthur P. Golf Scramble. Friday, August 5th at Devil's Ridge in Oxford.
Hit the links with me, Big Daddy Arthur P. Win big with a hole-in-one challenge and ride off on a brand new hog, courtesy of Motor City Harley-Davidson in Farmington Hills. There's a live DJ spinning the tunes, tons of food, and the hottest prizes like $100 golf prize packs, gear from Callaway, Top Flight, Tatermain, and more, courtesy of Motor City Golf Warehouse. Come on out and have a great old time with me, Big Daddy Arthur P. But remember, this is event sells out every year, so don't wait. Book your foursome today by calling 248-591-6841. You can also book online at WRIF.com or in person at Motor City Golf Warehouse in Novi.
The original is still the best. The 7th Annual Arthur Penhallow Golf Scramble. Friday, August 5th at Devil's Ridge in Oxford. Brought to you by Motor City Golf Warehouse in Novi's Main Street District, where lower prices lead to lower scores. Michelob Ultra. Lose the carbs, not the taste. Limousine Express. And 101 WRIF.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual when he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the Total Transformation. The program then helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. Defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. As usual, I always start a controversy every time around this year when I contend that the atomic bombing of Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was unnecessary. So we've gotten a lot of emails. A few people saying it was necessary, a lot of other people adding to what is called revisionist history, revising the official history to say that it wasn't. But I like to talk about historical subjects, but that, you follow the dots and it leads to now. We live in a world that was not made safer by using those at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but rather, as I said, let the genie out of the bottle, and now we live in fear that still there could be an exchange of nuclear weapons, including from Russia. Russia now is our pals, sort of, but they're armed to the teeth. They wanted to cut a deal with the United States where they would reduce nuclear weapons to almost nothing. George Bush said, no, we're not doing that. In fact, we are going to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons to fight who? Well, I'll tell you, China and Russia knows that they are the targets. China and Russia know that they're the targets. Who else? Tasmania? All right. Actually, it's not a country, is it? It's an island south of Australia. This is from Sergeant Tim. I don't say last names unless people say it's okay. I just discovered your station on the internet. I wish I knew about it a long time ago. I'm listening to you live from Adana, Turkey. I'm in the Air Force and have been stationed here for 14 months. Nice to finally be able to listen to an American broadcast. I leave in 1 month and can't wait to get the hell out of here. Thanks for playing great music. I'll continue to listen in. So maybe that's not directed at me. That's just directed at our music. But anyways, we go all over the world. Now, I said earlier that I had listeners from 13 to 83, and probably everybody, most everybody, accepted the official interpretation of the necessity of bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And let's see, Zach, maybe I was thinking of him. He says he's 14 now. I think the first time I wrote you, I was 13. Does that mean I'm the youngest person to ever write? That'd be pretty cool. It was. You know, I called in a little while ago, but got dropped. Hey, we'll call in. I think we have open lines right now. 298-313 is the area code. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. And let me get my little mouse here. Come on, you. I hate mice. All right. There we go. This is Jack from Livingston, Montana, with a shout-out to him. So let's see. I think there were some other ones. Mark writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. They did not surrender after the first bomb, meaning, I guess, that it was necessary. I thought I had another one here. All right. We will go back. We'll go back to our phones. There are a couple open lines. 313-298-WRIF. Here's David from Oakland. David, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good. Thanks.
Surrender was imminent in that Japan thing. That was kind of, you know, a little bit of an explosion after the fact. I mean, it was done by that time. That was the big fear-based thing by America to try and make everybody else obviously afraid of them. I mean, it's definitely unnecessary that war was done. History toast. I don't know, the hypocrisy with the nuclear weapon and everything. I mean, what actually would give us the right to be the only ones to have nuclear weapons, to decide when, in fact, to use them, when it's right? Is it our morals, our way of life, our beliefs, our views? I mean, why is it okay for Pakistan and India to have nuclear weapons, but we can't allow Iran and Iraq to have them? Now, if they've got them, then why can't we develop something to shoot them down as they come up?
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to spending all of this on whatever. I mean, let them blow each other up. Who cares what they do over there anymore? We're losing too many of our lives. What do they have over there that we want so bad? Oh yeah, oil. That's right.
Yeah.
So we could bomb it all and make it a blacktop for Kmart and a big old oil stand out there, and that'd probably be really good idea with a lot of the, well, right wingers around here, I suppose. But if we could all just get along a little better, wouldn't that be something?
Well, I think that is the key to it, and things are going in the absolute opposite direction. And,
absolutely.
And, I mean, I think a lot of people are beginning to understand that. But thank you, David.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Dave. Hi, you're on the air. What city are you calling from?
I'm calling from Dearborn. When you were talking about that book you have on how to make nuclear bombs,
mm-hmm.
I went to the my local library, and I got a book called The Radioactive Boy Scout. I don't know if you remember this story, but it was 94 or 95 maybe, about a 16 or 17-year-old in Commerce Township. The kid was like a genius. He built a nuclear reactor out of, well, not everyday chemicals, but chemicals he could get in his mom's potting shed in his backyard. And according to the book, he was able to get smoke detectors, which use a non-harmful radioactive material,
right,
to, you know, sense the smoke. And he was able to get those, and he isolated some other chemicals. Like, he would go to, antique stores, and you get these old clocks from the 30s and 40s where the glow-in-the-dark paint was
radium.
Radium.
You can actually, I don't know, is this technologically correct? Does this make sense?
He got a lot of his information from the NRC, and he purified uranium up to 9,000 times higher than what the government considers safe. And the book is basically a how-to. You know?
Yeah, well, so was the one I was reading. But this was pretty complicated stuff. I think he had to have centrifuges, fuges, or whatever they are, and all that. Yeah.
All right.
You got to go?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But it's the book's called The Radioactive Boy Scout.
All right.
And it's very, very interesting. It's like a how-to book.
All right, thank you very much.
Talk to you later.
Appreciate you calling. I suspect he, what do we call him? Petroleum transfer agent. Right, yeah. Pumping gas. All right. Here is Kevin calling in from Warren. Kevin, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I'd just like to start off to say that I've listened to your show since I've been a teenager to a young adult, and I've always been impressed on your views. And, you know, like you say, you read, you gain knowledge, but a lot of it comes from the heart. For me... I think more of myself as somebody that studies humanity. You know, I'm not by any means educated in as far as foreign policy, politics, or that. It's just, you know, peace.
Sure.
And, you know, I believe that all the hatred in the world is a learned behavior. You know, as far as taught down through the generations, and I think it's, you know, it's time to stop. you know, I don't, you know, it all starts not with the bigger, you know, facets of the countries, the nations. It starts more locally, as state and local, you know, levels, where, you know, people just start looking inward at their own areas and start fixing from within and start healing from within, to, you know, to help themselves so they're able to help others.
No, I think that's a good, you know, there was a, I guess, a psychologist, you'd call him. His name was Wilhelm Reich, like the Third Reich, except he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a Nazi. It was just his name, Wilhelm Reich. And he talked about the emotional plague, one filled with anger and submission to submission to authority, and all the elements of modern society that kept the hatred and the violence and at an individual level of never being able to get full gratification. And when an individual isn't able to get full gratification, then he or she extends it into the nation state and its glories and its wars and its rivalries. And that's why countries can be whipped up. I mean, he was looking at his own country of Germany. But the emotional plague means that it is passed, that it's a pathogen that's passed down from even from generation to generation.
Right. I just, you know, getting back to your subject, I've had a lot of family, fighting during World War II, so, you know, it's come up. I've had discussions as far as the bombing of Japan, but one thing I would like to say, I do not forsake the efforts of any of the, you know, servicemen or women. The ones that are currently in Iraq, you know, we as a nation have to love those people over there. And all over the world, they're defending our, you know, our Constitution, our Declaration. They're defending what our nation stands for. Now, as far as...
let me say, I don't. This is no criticism of them, but I don't think that's what's happening. I think that Bush lied about the reasons for going to war in Iraq and has sent those people who are charged with exactly doing what you said, defending our nation, defending our Constitution, defending our way of life. But actually, that's not what they're doing. That's part of this insane policy that Bush and his gang put together. And to me, he should be impeached, and all the troops ought to be brought home immediately.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, as far as being in the military, I don't, you know, a lot of people that do go in the service, they go in, you know, knowingly. They are taking orders. They are doing what I believe to the best of their belief system, under orders of a higher authority. You know, they signed on for this, and they have to follow orders.
Well, no, that's exactly. And there's not a single man or woman in Iraq wearing a United States uniform that decided, I got a good idea, I'm going to go over to Iraq and do whatever. I mean, they were all ordered over there. And so the person ultimately responsible for this is the person that made the decision to send them there. All right, I got to get some commercials in before midnight, so thank you very much for calling and for your opinion. We'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Luxury Limousine of Dearborn places you in the lap of luxury, and their staff provides you with unparalleled customer service. You pick the car, and they'll pick you up. Luxury Limousine offers one-of-a-kind limo service for every occasion, and they have vehicles that aren't available in Michigan. Whether you're looking for a ride in one of their stretch Escalades, Mercedes-Benz, BMW X5, H2 Hummer, or more, Luxury Limousine has what you're looking for. Luxury Limousine guarantees that all of their vehicles are ready for you when you need them. They even have the Infiniti QX56 with a VIP section, which is unique and unsurpassed in quality. Travel in style to weddings, anniversaries, proms, parties, romantic nights out, or any special occasion. Call Luxury Limousine at 866-467-7700 to book a reservation today. That's 866-467-7700. And check them out online at luxuryviplimo.com to preview all of the options. If you pick Luxury Limousine, you've made the right choice.
The party just doesn't stop. Tuesday nights with The Riff at Leopard's Lounge and Broil, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Join 101 WRIF this and every Tuesday night for Riff Night at Leopard's Lounge and Broil. There'll be a ton of Riff gear to give away and lots of other surprises, but you can't get them if you don't come out. Every week at Leopard's Lounge, they bring you new girls from all over the world, so it never gets boring. And these girls are hot. Plus, unlike other gentlemen's clubs, at Leopard's Lounge, you never pay a cover charge. Ever. It's the best entertainment value around. Come on, guys. You work hard. You deserve a night out. So make sure you make it Riff Night this Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge and enjoy the finer things in life. You know what I'm talking about. Beer and sexy, beautiful women. We'll see you at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor, just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge in Broil.
Transportation provided by Royal Limousine in Plymouth. Call 866-MY-ROYAL.
Yeehaw! Well, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Jeep Charlie from Mark Chevrolet. Now, why do they call me Jeep Charlie? Because Mark Chevrolet sells Chevy so cheap, no one can beat our deals. We even hired a big announcer to tell you about it. Go ahead, announcer boy.
This month at Mark Chevrolet, get the 2005 Chevy Equinox just $319 per month. The Chevy Cobalt $198 per month. The popular 2005 Malibu just $233 per month. And the 2005 Chevy Trailblazer just $252 per month. And remember, everyone gets the GM employee price. All payments plus tax, license, and acquisition fee. All rebates to dealer. Amount due at signing is with lease loyalty. Remember, if you didn't check Mark Chevrolet, you didn't get your best deal. Chevy, an American revolution.
Well, thank you. Hey, and remember, if you think their new cars are cheap, you want to see Mark Chevrolet's great selection of used cars. Well, they're so cheap, even the birds are singing cheap, cheap, cheap. You've heard them. If you like their new car smell, we got a car to sell. Mark Chevrolet, Michigan Avenue in Wayne. Get there.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Tenney Street Roadhouse, located at West Village Drive in the heart of West Dearborn. Tenney Street Roadhouse features great American food and great American music. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
HQ, reconnaissance report from the field. I've got something strange here. Better tell the folks at Esurance.
What are you looking at, Special Agent?
It's some kind of robot cutting down trees for all the paper used by other auto insurance companies.
What?
You heard me. Other companies use a lot more paper than Esurance with easy electronic billing and renewal.
Esurance saves a lot of paper.
Which helps save the environment. Electronic documents also help Esurance keep auto insurance rates reasonable.
So you save some green for your wallet and the environment. But Esurance's electronic documents must help you save time, too.
Definitely. With Esurance, you don't have to wait for anything in the mail. Everything's instant because it's electronic. Once you buy your Esurance policy, you can print your insurance cards anytime.
That's why if you're on the go, you've got to have Esurance.
Roger that. I'll get back to HQ so I can start work to get rid of that paper-eating robot.
Affirmative. Save some green at Esurance. Get your auto insurance quote at Esurance.com today.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour at 1 a.m. We're going to be talking with David Bacon about the AFL-CIO conference in Chicago. big split there. And interestingly, though, this is a federation of unions that has always backed U.S. foreign policy, but they have passed an anti-war resolution condemning the war in Iraq and calling for, what they say, rapid withdrawal. If you're just joining us, welcome. You can call 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, or email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My website, peterwerby.com. Rebroadcasts will occur tomorrow at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. at radiopower.org, radiopower.org, and archived at whiterosesociety.org as well. Soon this will be podcast. We're broadcasting in HD radio. That's all of the technical stuff. Please join us. James, listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, writes in, the Bush administration was so intent on invading Iraq that it ignored or refused to hear the many voices which predicted a variety of outcomes that closely resemble the disaster that's been unleashed. So in other words, all the critics of the war turned out to be absolutely right. And everything, whether you're kind enough to the Bush mob and say it was mistakes, or less kind, like myself and others that it said, say that it was purposeful lies, everything the critics said have turned out to be true. But James says, it's my fear that Bush and his pack of neocons are operating in the same alternative reality when it comes to the use of nuclear weapons in conventional warfare. He says, I'm convinced that given the opening, Bush would give the go-ahead to use a nuclear bunker buster in the belief that it would advance the cause of freedom, with little or no adverse fallout. Well, yeah. So this is, what essentially is being said by James is this is an administration that has made bad choice after bad choice, wrong move after wrong move, no matter where, what area of decision-making it's been all about. Also, and I didn't mention this tonight, Bruce writes in, there are 8 of us in the Tom Hartman chat room. You can go to tomhartman.com, tomhartman.com, and if you sign up for his, he's a national talk show host and a buddy of mine, and he has a chat room, and people use it during my show. I don't know if this is a lot or a little for a chat room. He says, Bruce says there's 8 people involved in it. Doesn't seem to me it's too many. It's kind of weird. You know, you listen to Night Call with Peter Werby and you're in the Tom Hartman chat room. But the 8 people meet every Sunday to discuss and listen to the show. And he says, when are you going to do a daily show again? I don't know. Anyways, from the Southern contingent in the war on conservatism. yeah, I like that. All right, let's go back to our phones, 313-298-WRIF, and this is Carl in Roseville. Carl, it's Peter Werby. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
Hold on for a minute.
Hi.
I'm at work.
Well, I'm going to have to get back to you here. We're going to put you back on. That, you know, that's what happens. I love it, though. Here, let's go to Unknown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, who's this?
Hey, it's Chuck from Detroit.
Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hey, I've been a long-time listener, a first-time caller, and I really like the way you handle the point of views and talk things out intelligently instead of just podding people down and having your way and so on, like, you know, making intelligent points out. But what I mainly called to say is I didn't hear anybody talking. I've seen on CNN on the Internet where Japan in the next year has put their money into having a supercomputer 72 times faster than any computer.
Yeah.
And hearing about this Pearl Harbor and that's not a... We took our money and our people and spread them way too thin, and what, $300 billion now? And they put it into a supercomputer that will probably have the capability of striking 72 times faster.
Wow.
I've seen it on CNN. They said within the next year, and it's Japan.
So what does that mean? What does that mean practically? I mean,
well, it just scares me a little bit that they could hit us 72 times before we could hit them once.
Wait. We hit us. What do you mean?
Well, just talk about. I was listening all this time to the radio talking about Hiroshima and possible retaliation.
Oh.
You know, the old war wounds haven't healed yet.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of times, if you look back in ancient history, you think like Rome or somebody dealt someone a final blow, and then all of a sudden, 50 years later, 100 years later, they're back.
It's kind of hard to forget someone dropped an atomic bomb on you. That's what I was thinking. And now they're going to have a computer 72 times faster than us. Is that what they were kind of thinking? We'll put our money in technology and we're going to be the strongest?
Well, I sure hope not. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thank you for joining us. Let me see. Oh, yeah. Let's do this, because we were talking earlier how that somebody complains that all we do is talk about the war in Iraq. We never talk about anything else. And I would say it's kind of hard when every day 50 to 100 people are dying, usually four or five Americans. On my site, peterwerby.com, I update the number of people dead in what I call Bush's Slaughtergate. Slaughtergate is what's going on. Bush responsible because he's the commander-in-chief. He may be a sock puppet for Cheney or for the neocons or whoever, but ultimately he's made the final decision. So to me, it's Slaughtergate. And and I always have to check myself, because sometimes I put the figures up there, and I think I've mentioned this before, and I get this feeling, you know, oh, there's more proof how what a bad decision Bush made and what the consequences of it. But then I realize, I mean, these are live human beings that, poof, just gone. They're gone. They're gone because George Bush made a mistake, if you're kind. And if you're accurate, I would say, lied to the American people to get us involved in the war. Anyways, what I always want trying to get together to want to talk about is the economy and how that Bush has had a hand in ruining that. Not for everybody. I mean, I'm amazed when I go to some of the wealthier suburbs around Detroit and see life there. But increasingly, the stories from the middle class and from the working class, certainly from the working poor and the dirt poor people, are beginning to accelerate. Now, I saw this. This is pretty good-hearted. This is WRIF's Meltdown. Meltdown is a DJ in the evenings here on Riff, and he's putting together a benefit for U.S. veterans of the Iraqi War. A benefit for the U.S. veterans of the Iraqi War. And I thought about this some. And one of the first things that struck me, tell me if that doesn't strike you as well, is why is there a necessity of a benefit for veterans? Why, after being sent to a war for good reasons or ill, isn't the government that sent them there taking care of them? Why does a good-hearted, although I disagree with him totally politically, he is so far right-wing, Meltdown is. But this isn't about that. This is about being good-hearted and open-hearted and being part of a community that helps one another. But why do these men and some women have to be helped? Well, all right, let's go to, and it has to do with the economy. Let me ask Jay Hudson, our producer and phone screener, is there someone on line three, or should I hang up on that? Write me a little note here. All right, the economy. Here's a poll that finds voters deeply disillusioned with the national economy. Only 36% of us believe the country is headed in the right direction. This represents a significant darkening in the nation's mood since the last survey 5 months ago, and it's the lowest point since National Public Radio began polling regularly in May 2003. Only 43% of voters approve of the president's handling of the economy. I mean, there's only all of his policies benefit about 5% of the population. So how can he have 43%? I mean, are people that dumb? Maybe they are. All right, I'm gonna hang this one up, Jay, because I think that's that should be. No, that's not it. That's not it. Ooh, it's one of those ones you can't hang up. How weird is that? All right, wait a minute here. We're gonna do that. Nope. All right, I guess it'll have to stay. The worry about the economy is eroding support for Republicans in places where the president has run well on values, particularly non-college-educated older women and rural voters. I mean, it's rural America that's fighting in Iraq, by the way. I mean, overwhelmingly, And why? Because it's young men and women driven by deteriorating economic circumstances that think they can get out of their situation. And they can, as long as they don't get their face blown off. But the economy is really awful for rural Americans. And you've probably seen all this. And this, again, like I say, we don't ever get into talk about this. Kodak laying off 10,000 workers. GM posting third straight quarterly loss. Kimberly-Clark plans to cut about 6,000 jobs. Hewlett-Packard to lay off 14,500 jobs. Now, workers, rather. Now, I don't know, what is that? 10,000, pardon me, 10,000, 16,000... 14,000. So that's like 30,000 workers just by these three companies are being laid off. And where's the 43% of the economy thinks, or the, sorry, 43% of people polled thinks Bush is giving good leadership on the economy? Now, you got to remember that they're not somewhat in a few of these cases, but mostly what's happening here is a speed up. More production is ground out of fewer people. So rather than having production that goes along at a pace that people can deal with, whether it's in the office or on a production line, there's the old-fashioned what's called a speed-up of production. So more, this is how companies can squeeze more profit out of the same amount of production. You pay less people to produce the same amount, and you sell it for the same price. And it's not like these companies are doing poorly. Many of them, some of them having problems, some of them... just figuring this is a great way in order to get more profits for our stockholders. If it means screwing up the lives of 30,000 families, I mean, some of these people may be single, but think what all this does, the aggregate misery that's created by these layoffs. Is this an economy that's working well? Well, it's going to wind up working pretty well for a third of the American population, and real well for about 10% of it. I'm not even giving it, well, all right, I don't know, these figures I'm kind of just grabbing out of the air. But a good 60% of us, we're looking at the third world, folks. Yeah? We're going to be competing with people making not very much money. And you see these headlines, even very conservative newspapers like the Detroit News. One-third of all Michigan children live in homes where no adult holds a full-time, year-round job. Wait a minute, I may not be reading this right. One-third of all Michigan children... This is incredible. One-third of all Michigan children live in homes where no adult holds a full-time, year-round job, according to a report issued by Kids Count in Michigan. More than 100,000 children live in homes where no adult works at all. So there's much more that where the children live in. A third of it. A third of our population in Michigan, in the United States of America, in an industrial country. The annual report, which catalogs the state of Michigan children, documents a 44% increase between 2000 and 2003 in the number of children living in homes where no adult has worked in the past 12 months. 2000 and 2003. Has there been any significant occurrence during that time? I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah. George Bush stole the election in 2000 and started giving away money to the wealthy at the expense of... children. When you hear family values out of the mouths of these hypocrites, I don't know, I can't even say what I was going to say. And then I think it's today, yeah, Sunday, July 31st. These heart-wrenching stories about Detroit area people. Scrimping single parent doubts $7.15 is the answer. And that's what she that she was working for, $6 an hour. Clerical job helps pay bills for a grandmother, 70. She couldn't get by on her Social Security check, $432 a month. We wanted to give someone who had worked all their lives in America. So she got a job at a minimum wage clerical job, and it still is not enough. She said, I love my job, but it's impossible to exist on minimum wage. A gallon of milk costs between $3 and $4. That may not seem like much to most people, but it's about what I take home for 1 hour of work. When I have to fill the gas tank in my car, it takes more than half a day's wages. Is anybody's tear ducts other than mine getting tugged at? A 70-year-old grandmother, single woman, and she can't make it. It's terrible. Mom self-sufficiency plan stall. Just another heartbreaking story. But a restaurateur fears hike's ripple effect. Now, he runs an Arby's. His name is Mark Mitra. And he pays his workers above the minimum wage at his four Arby's restaurants in Metro Detroit. He pays them, let me see, if it goes up to seven, he's paying them now $7.15 an hour. What is that, 40 hours a week? I can't even do the math. But yeah, $280 a week. So these are people, he's paying people like, I can't do the math that quickly. Between $10,000 and $12,000 a year. Who can live on that? It's kids. It's not kids anymore. It's people that got blown out of the industrial jobs. And these Bush people say, ultimately it'll be good for the economy. And he fears that the minimum wage is going to go up to $7 an hour. I think even at $7 an hour, the United States, the richest country in the world, would still have the lowest minimum wage. Someone have to check me on that. But I know countries in Europe have $11, $12 an hour. This is the greatest country in the world? This is the richest country in the world? Why can't we afford to have a minimum wage of $10 and $12 a year? You think it has anything to do with what's happening to all our money? It just goes down the rat hole of defense and war? Not even defense, all war. Think that could be? And they always say, oh, we got to pay those, because we have to be competitive. There was an interesting article about Costco, how Costco, which is one of those discount places, became the anti-Walmart. And Costco's average pay, you ready for this? $17 an hour. 42% higher than its fiercest rival, Sam's Club. And Costco's health plan make those and many other retailers look like Scrooge. So they figured out, or one level, or they have some humanity or some ethical grounding, unlike the bandit family that runs Walmart, that destroys businesses and communities and will close up its business, close up a branch rather than let people join a union. How about this? Let me see if I can find this real quickly. Yeah. Talking about these, I won't tell you who it is, but here's a young man talking about joining the Army. It's the benefits. He took an aptitude test to join the Army. Taking a break from his $3.25 an hour job at McDonald's. Taking a break from his $3.25 an hour job at McDonald's. And you're thinking about, wait a minute, isn't the U.S. minimum wage $5.15? Well, he's probably in another country. Well, actually, he's in, where is this? One of the countries, either on Guam, Saipan, or American Samoa. And per capita, those are the American, and they're all Americans. They have USA on their license plate. Those are the Americans that have the highest per capita presence in Iraq. And this is what they're driven by. So you're wondering, well, in fact, it says, from Pago Pago in American Samoa to Yap in Micronesia, 4,000 miles to the west. These were trophies of World War II, by the way. Army recruiters are scouring the Pacific looking for high school graduates to enlist at a time when the Iraq War is turning off many candidates in the States. So go get these people that are making $3.25 an hour, and the minimum signing bonus is $5,000. Well, you can imagine what kind of pull that has. And why is it 3.25? Because people like Tom DeLay, the head of the Republicans in the House, acting at the behest of lobbyists, made sure that this pitiful, embarrassing, disgraceful U.S. minimum wage, that that's so low that didn't apply to territories like this. All right, so we talked about the economy. What are we going to do? That's what's so hard. Hopefully, And I don't know whether this split in the AFL-CIO in Chicago with the Teamsters and the restaurant workers and the service workers leaving is good or bad. Could just turn out to split this already pitifully weak organized labor movement, of which I'm a part. I'm a member of an AFL union that didn't split. We're pretty small, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. Or maybe it will lead to a period of militancy, because if it doesn't, hey, start looking for these, instead of minimum wage going up, look for it going down. These Republicans, these conservatives, want us at the mercy of what they call the free market. Actually, it's just the market. So if you bring potatoes to market and somebody's already brought like a ton, people have already brought a lot more, well, you're not going to get offered very much. Well, in the global labor market, if the market rules, we all get screwed other than the rich people. I mean, it's pretty much happened as it is. As you know, we've talked about 600 or 700 men control about $2 trillion worth of wealth, and the rest of the 5 billion on the planet, I don't even think control that much. So 600 or 700 men versus billions. So that's what they like. And they get people to buy into this crap about the free market. It's not free. What they mean, they have the free and unfettered ability to withdraw profit from it, where they can do things like we were talking at Hewlett-Packard and Kodak and what have you, and other companies like that, to squeeze more and more out of us. Either they pay people wages that are literally criminal, at least if you have an ethical sense, overseas, because, gee, people in the United States want a living wage. How terrible is that? What awful people we are. How stupid we are, because now we've driven jobs to foreign shores because we wanted to live a middle-class life. I mean, we never should have organized unions, and we never should have put in child labor laws. We never should have put in safety and health laws, right? Because then we would have been competitive. And we could all be working for the $3.25 an hour they make on Saipan, and have no pensions and no retirement and no health care, but at least we'd have a job. And all the people that these conservatives, I mean, the wealthy conservatives, you can understand it. They have a robber baron mentality. But the morons in the middle class, in the working class, that say, oh, well, it's their money and they have the right to do it. I mean, people cutting their own throat, how stupid can you get? 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Your opinion, please. Welcome to the broadcast. Who's this?
Hey, it's Sandy. How you doing?
Hi, Sandy. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Shelby.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, you know what? You were just talking about the restaurants and everything else, and I make more than double the minimum wage in the restaurant business.
Good.
But going back to government, I pay half of that to child support.
Yeah, well,
yes, and which is fine to a point, but how am I supposed to live?
Man, I can't begin to tell you, Sandy, how many men I've heard that from over the years. Well, yeah, because you get screwed, and without it, she and your child get screwed, right?
Well, right, you know, and it's just, I don't know. I don't understand.
Well, you know, in other countries, the governments, rather than spending these extraordinary amounts on preparation for war, actually reward families and pay stipends, pay monthly, I don't know, someone from Canada will have to call in and remind me. But if you have a child in Canada, I think the government gives you X number of dollars every month because they don't want their children. Like I was reading that thing from the Detroit News where you have 100,000 kids living in, pardon me, in dire poverty. You know what happens to children, when, to their health, to their emotional being, to their sense of confidence operating in the world if they don't get enough money. So, I mean, let me tell you this. There's no way in the world that someone making $10 an hour should have to pay child support. On the other hand, there's no reason, well, not on the other hand, but alternately, there shouldn't be a situation where your child in a relationship that didn't work out or whatever the circumstances were should have to go without. So we kind of have our choices. We can spend $750 million, which is going to be the price tag, on fighting this fool's errand in Iraq, or we can take care of our families and people like you.
Well,
see, and I agree with that. I mean, you know, I cover the health insurance and everything else, plus I pay half my paycheck for child support.
I don't know how you live.
Me neither. You know, but hey, that's the government for you.
Yeah, well, there's got to be change. See, part of the problem is, in other periods in the history, there were people organizing, not the government. In fact, usually they had to organize against the government, like the original unions in the 30s.
Right.
And now, I mean, there's people with good ideas and people with proposals, but unless it starts taking some real serious political and social form, we're going to just keep getting screwed more and more. More and more and more of our money is going to be taken out of our taxes, and we'll get back less and less from it. I mean, how can someone like me, who's making more than $10 an hour, although I don't, sometimes people think someone like myself is fabulously wealthy, which I can tell you I'm extraordinarily far from that. I just have a modest home in a modest suburb, and I don't have children, and I've just, I don't know, had a lot of good breaks. But sort of lost my point. But I sympathize with you, because sometimes I realize how lucky I am and what other people have to do to make not to come home with not very much in their pocket. So hopefully things will turn around. I mean, at some point, I just think people are going to say, we're not going to take this anymore.
Well, I hope so, too. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, and good luck on it. I mean, I do have this little scene in our house, my wife and I, where every once in a while we say, do you not realize how lucky we are? I mean, it's not all luck. I mean, part of it is. I mean, there is a international wheel of misfortune. That so if you get born in Africa or a lot of parts of Latin America or Asia, you don't have a chance. And some of that is true here. Part of it has to do where you come from. I mean, obviously, if you come from a middle-class background like I did, you have a lot more chances. And also, if you screw up, like I did a lot, I never got a college education. I actually didn't even finish high school till I was 20. I was kind of, what would you say? I didn't do well in school or anything like that. So, but if you're middle-class, you can make a lot of mistakes. And if you're wealthy, you can make extraordinary mistakes. That's what I always say about George Bush. Every time he screws up in business, and he screwed up a lot, you go look at his histories. Hey, it doesn't make any difference. Got a rich daddy, got a powerful daddy, got a influential daddy. Whereas if you make mistakes and you're poor, well, you don't get to come out of it very easily, very frequently. All right, let's go to Terry in Dearborn. Terry, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Peter.
Hi.
I called in about the nuclear bomb, but I got a point I want to make on the economy. The minimum wage back in 1968 was at its highest. It was equivalent to $8.80 an hour to today's pay.
Okay.
And the economy was great. There's no reason why we couldn't have the same sort of minimum wage today. But anyway, on the nuclear
bomb. Hey, Terry, wait. One thing. Could you turn your radio completely off?
Sure.
Because we're doing now, we have this HD radio, and that makes it go through like 8 seconds later. And I don't know how you can talk with that going in the back, Terry, but drive me nuts. So thank you.
You're a very sensitive guy. I could barely hear it.
Okay.
But anyway, so on the nuclear bomb, I think two things are, common sense will tell you two things. One, there's really nothing the atomic bomb could do to the Japanese that conventional weapons couldn't also do, just in a longer period of time.
Right.
And two, the argument that, we had to drop a nuclear bomb, that's the only way to end that war, then how did every other war in history end without a nuclear bomb? And plus, did you know Dwight D. Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, wrote in his memoirs that the dropping of the nuclear bomb on Japan was completely unnecessary. Not, unfortunate, but necessary, completely unnecessary. And a lot of other generals said it was really not
sure.
The factor that ended the war either.
Well, I'll tell you, Terry, the only people that argued it was a necessity or that for the go-ahead were politicians that saw it all in political terms. The men, as you're indicating very correctly, General LeMay, I can't even remember the head of submarine warfare, as I said earlier, the final, the U.S. bombing survey or something like that. Every military observer with the run-up to using the atomic bomb, and after said it was absolutely unnecessary to bring the war to an end. But politically, to force it to an end on the terms the United States wanted, we just kind of incinerated a few hundred thousand Japanese.
I think they had a new toy and just determined to use it.
Well, there was some of that as well, yeah.
But to use that on civilians was just way beyond any reasonable, beyond the pale. Just, they could at least drop down on a military target, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, if you think about it, the Japanese did. I mean, everybody did that. I mean, the United States started off at the beginning in Europe of only willing to fly bombing flights over Germany during the daytime because they said it was too indiscriminate. By the end of the war, they had already been constructing out in Nevada replicas of German working-class district homes to see how they would burn with napalm. And in fact, created this hideous firestorm in Dresden that they don't know may have killed 125,000 people. So to some extent, the weaponry, the so-called conventional weaponry that was used on Hamburg and Dresden and Tokyo, was in some cases, I think more people died in one of those cities than died in Nagasaki. So you're right. It really wasn't necessary. And that's what LeMay said. We can conventionally bomb Japan into surrender.
Plus, Japan was completely defenseless. They had no navy, no air force. They couldn't even have come close to shooting down a bomber flying right over their home island.
Right.
So they're completely defenseless.
They were indeed.
Yeah.
All right, Terry, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Here, I meant to have just kind of drop in these little things like this. There is this herb called echinacea. Echinacea, and it looks like echinacea, right? E-C-H-I-N-A-C-E-A, echinacea. And this study, the herbal supplement that's made from the purple cone flower, it's used by millions of Americans and used all over Europe, particularly to prevent or treat colds. Apparently, according to the study in the New England Journal of Medicine, says it neither prevents colds nor erase cold symptoms in a large and rigorous study. I probably could have gotten more calls on this because I have, and my friends swear by it. They did a study. They took 437 people who volunteered to have cold viruses dripped into their noses. Who does this? Actually, a guy I know that has a newspaper called Guinea Pig Zero. You can go Google that. And he does that. He volunteers for all these studies. That's how he makes his money. And so he's done a lot of... he writes a lot, and other people do that do it. So it's Guinea... I think it's the name of it, Guinea Pig Zero. Anyways, they had 437 people volunteered to have cold viruses dripped into their noses. Some swallowed echinacea for a week beforehand. Others a placebo. A zero, nothing. Still others took echinacea or a placebo at the time they were infected. The subjects were secluded for 5 days while scientists examined them for symptoms and took nasal washings to look for the virus. Investigators found that those who took echinacea fared no differently from those who took a placebo. They were just as likely to catch a cold. Their symptoms were just as severe, and they had just as much virus in their nasal secretions. Stephen F. Strauss, director of the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, the government agency. So people say, well, there you go. He said, we've got to stop attributing any efficacy to echinacea, that it works. All right, right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Welcome to Art Appreciation 101. Here we have the exquisite and stunning favorite, latex upon bosom, that in all of the world can only be found in one place.
You knew we were talking about Wild Woodies, right?
Summer's hottest contest wraps up with Metro Detroit's hottest body. It's the last blast as Wild Woodies and Roseville and 101 WRIF present the Latex Bikini Contest Finals.
Sponsored by Mia Photography.
This Wednesday night, head to Wild Woodies to check out the hotties of AT&T Model Management as Wild Woody's literally pours it on. We're talking latex painted on bikinis so real you'll want to reach right out and... Okay, it's best to simply enjoy the eye candy, but you do get to vote for your favorite. Join the doctor, Doug Podell from 101WRIF for the Eastside's hottest Wednesday night party. Play wicked games for killer riff prizes and vote for the latex bikini contest champion.
What's my motivation?
You can check out the photos online at miaphoto.com. There's plenty of inspiration to come out to Wild Woody's every week. The latex bikini contest finals, only at the Eastside's premier party place, Wild Woody's, on Gratiot, just minutes from 696 or I-94 in Rockin' Roseville.
Wild Woody's.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a new career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-903-1919 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-903-1919. That's 1-800-903-1919.
Hey, it's the Doc, Doug Podell from the Riff. Well, the warmer weather has finally showed up, and it's got kind of hot in a hurry. Upper 80s, gobs of humidity. A few weeks ago, we were looking for ways to warm up. Now we're looking for ways to cool down. Well, here's great news from your doctor. The folks at Dunkin' Donuts have come up with a great way to cool off this summer. Introducing Dunkin' Donuts brand new flavored ice coffees. They're perfect for the warmer months because they're so cool and refreshing. Double brewed and served over ice with the extra added kick of delicious blueberry or coconut flavoring. Dunkin' Donuts has the everyday alternative to soft drinks. The new Dunkin' Donuts iced coffees will satisfy your thirst and give you the lift you need to keep up with your busy day. Talking about recharging your batteries with something smooth, invigorating, and unique. Plus, it's perfect any time of the day. Pick one up today at your neighborhood Dunkin' Donuts. Bring yourself back with Dunkin' Donuts brand new flavored iced coffees. Just tell them the Doc from the Riff sent you. But don't wait, because they're available only for a limited time. Dunkin' Donuts, bring yourself back.
Hear that? That's the sound of innovative thinking. Comerica Park, designed by a Lawrence Tech graduate, Comerica's more than a ballpark. It's a place where urban planning, architecture, and family entertainment seamlessly come together like never before. A unique solution to the challenge of building a park that satisfies baseball purists and non-purists alike, and at the same time, revitalizing an entire community. It's the kind of inspired thinking that's a hallmark of a Lawrence Tech graduate. Because at Lawrence Tech, we believe in surrounding our students with the tools and inspiration they need to make a difference, whether it's building ballparks or a solid future. Lawrence Tech. The future in the making.
Prepare for your future at the university whose graduates change the world. During on-the-spot admission days, August 3rd or 9th, explore Lawrence Tech's state-of-the-art facilities and nationally recognized programs. Apply for over 60 undergrad, master's, or doctoral degrees and waive your application fee. Call 800-CALL-LTU, extension 1, or visit ltu.edu.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment, 313-298-WRIF. At 1 a.m., we'll be talking with labor reporter David Bacon about the AFL-CIO conference in Chicago that just ended, the split that occurred, and also the strong anti-war resolution that was passed. Now, the AFL was always such a tool of American foreign policy that sometimes it was called by critics the AFL-CIA. So this is a real break. Things, they may be a-changing. Steve writes in the calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It said that the war in Iraq is projected to cost $750 billion for the war in Iraq. And he said, I said a billion. Well, God, that what is that going? Less than a month, about a week or something like that. So, yeah, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the war in Iraq will cost the American taxpayer $750 billion. So there goes a lot of what we could possibly have. So we've got to spread democracy, right? So that's not exactly what is happening there. A couple other emails. Mike says he lives in Garden City, very blue collar. Boy, I said that weird, didn't I? Very blue collar. There you go. Works in Plymouth Township. It's a broken record, he says. My job a little over a week ago cut me back to strictly 40 hours per week. This really sucked because I depended on the 10 or so hours of overtime per week to make ends meet. Then about 2 weeks ago into this cutback, they unloaded more to my job description, and now I have about 2.5 people's amount of work to do in my 8-hour shift. Oh, and believe me, if you don't get everything done, you have two choices. Hear it from the higher-ups as to why I didn't get all of my work done, or work overtime for free to get it done. Well, that's the direction that labor is going to, particularly in the working class, but also in the middle class with all these cutbacks. Because when you cut 14,500 jobs from, where was that, Hewlett-Packard or Kimberly-Clark, I can't remember which one, the same amount of work is there. So this is 19th century. And these companies, of course, that fought labor laws, that they fought unionization, they fought everything that workers over 100 years, 150 years, fought and died for, they see the possibility of rolling it all back. And if you think, oh, well, I'm doing fine, and you know, too bad, why don't they get a different job or something like that? For one thing, it is criminal that Mike has to work 50 hours a week just to get by. You know, in a country like, is he going to really say France? Yeah, but a country like France, where the GNP is not as high, they work less. They figured it out. They'd rather consume less. They maybe have little smaller houses. They don't have 4,200 square feet unless you're the mayor or something like that, or the head of a company. But they have a lot more time and a lot more life at ease. I interviewed somebody that I played. They talked about in Europe they have the slow food movement as opposed to fast food. We love it because we can gobble down our food real quick and get to work. We ought to wear jumpsuits. We could just jump out of bed and jump into our jumpsuits and eat on the run. It's not the way for human beings to live. That's if your sole purpose for existence is an element of production, a thing, a cog, well, maybe then it makes some sense. Mark writes, and to help the economy, the government needs to stop borrowing. Mark, if it stops borrowing, the country and the economy goes bankrupt. Right now, the Chinese and the Japanese and other foreign bankers are borrowing money in order to prop up the economy. It's the only thing they can do. See any more here? Oh, yeah. We were talking about nuclear weapons and fallout. Jeremy in Windsor writes in, NASA studies show depleted uranium from weapons that the U.S. is using in Iraq, the dust could reach North America. And this is one of the untold stories of the Iraq War. Pardon me, just like it was in Gulf War I. A lot of thought to think that that the whole Gulf War syndrome was caused by this depleted uranium dust. They're hardened shells. They use this in metal. It doesn't do anything if just sitting. Could sit right here, wouldn't even set a meter going. If you atomize it, what happens when it hits something, this is all this dust in the air. All right, let's go back to our phones. Here is Andrew from Beverly Hills. Boy, he has been waiting a long time. Sorry, and welcome, and thanks for your patience.
Hey, that's all right, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
I just wanted to talk about the draft real quick.
Sure.
I really don't think it's that bad of an idea. I think if Bush had to send his daughters into the meat grinder with the rest of us, I think he'd be a lot more reluctant to go to war, and I think that, you know, the Senate might grow a backbone and, you know, keep him in check, and the media would do more of a job to keep our government in check. You know, I just don't think it's that bad of an idea.
Well, it would spread the misery. I mean, there's been a lot of talk in these opinion pieces lately to say that that the country's not sacrificing. There's some individual men and women that are sacrificing because they're over there in the meat grinder. But most of us, if we didn't have talk shows like this or didn't watch television, we wouldn't even have any idea that it's on. But politically, I'll tell you, Andrew, that it would be so explosive that whoever successfully signed it into law, whether it was a Republican like Bush or a Democrat, could probably kiss his political career goodbye.
Yeah, that's true.
But that might be good. I don't know what they're going to do for an army. As I was saying earlier, they're trying to they're sending the recruiters all through the Pacific Island possessions of the United States, trying to figure out, hey, maybe we can get some of these people from Saipan and Yap and the Mariana Islands over here to Iraq.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that the people that want war the most are the people that don't have to fight it. And, you know, it's really going to, you know, awaken the country, you know, to get us out of this, like, you know, coma, you know, this apathy that we're in, that we just, I mean, Bush is getting away with all this stuff, and I just don't see anybody really holding him responsible.
Well,
you know, I mean, in our country, you know, more than any other, that's the most important thing, because we're so powerful, we need to keep that power in check, and I just don't see it happening.
Well, if it for what it means, and they're going to have the Republicans are going to have to start dealing with this, because the opinion of Congress is extraordinarily low. Bush's poll ratings are lower than they have ever been. I mean, it doesn't mean anything now. If this was a country in Europe that had a parliamentary system, obviously the government would fall on a vote of no confidence, and we'd have to have new elections, and we would have a new government, which would be proper. Any number of these scandals. That have occurred. And the scandals in Bush's career now are beginning to line up with the ones that occurred during the Reagan and Bush 1 era. All right, Andrew, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Peter.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate hearing from you. Actually, this, in the 2nd Congressional District of Ohio, which Republicans have controlled for 20 years, the quickest route to political oblivion could be the one used by Paul Hackett, calling President Bush a chicken hawk for not serving in Vietnam and harshly criticizing the decision to invade Iraq. But Mr. Hackett, the Democratic candidate in the August 2nd special congressional election, is not an ordinary politician. Until 4 months ago, he was serving in the Marines, commanding a civil affairs unit in Iraq. If he's elected, he could become the first member of Congress to have served in the Iraq War. And let's see, where was that? Oh, yeah, this is from Roy in Placitas, New Mexico. He sends along a letter from... he calls him my Marine Reservist buddy, who was called up just after the last election. And he says, I've been following Paul Hackett's campaign in Ohio from here. I've contributed $100 to his campaign. Now this Marine is in Iraq, and he's sending money to this Iraq vet who's running on an anti-war platform. He sent $100 to his campaign. I've been working on my fellow Marines from the Ohio 2nd District to send money as well. All right, from Fenton, Michigan. Yeah, Fenton, Michigan. It's Roger. Roger,
hey, how you
there.
Doing?
Doing great.
How you doing, Peter? You got to remember Bush's saying, remember, if you can produce something somewhere else cheaper, it's a good thing, right?
Yeah, that means go ahead for outsourcing, right?
Right, but the big thing you just mentioned, Kodak, they were bought out not long ago when the head executives got, I think is literally in the tens of millions of dollars, they wiped out all the retirees' pensions.
Right.
You know, that's a new thing. And, like, I got a buddy, he had 15 years, and he gets laid off after 3 pay cuts, and this is a new thing they do now. He's making 20 an hour, but they keep the guys with 5 years that make 13 an hour.
Yeah.
You know that's just the new thing right now. And I'm telling you, if you think this Republican-controlled Congress of Michigan is going to raise it $2, I don't think it's going to happen.
Now, it probably seems doubtful. They'll say it'll hurt the economy. Hey, you know, these people are pure evil that are willing to limit or even destroy the lives of people that are working their butt off, pardon me, trying to keep a family together and what have you. But ultimately... I mean, it's like the 19th century when the economy was ruled by robber barons that would call out the National Guard and the Pinkerton detectives and goon squads and all to attack and kill workers that were fighting for their rights. But ultimately, people like us prevailed, and there was a fairly decent standard of living for many of us for a lot of years. So it eventually comes down to us. I mean, if we're depending on the goodness of the people who care nothing about nothing other than the bottom line, if we're caring about if we're counting on politicians to care about our welfare when they are being bought and paid for by these corporations, we're in for a bad run.
Oh, you aren't kidding. I got one other thing to say, too, about Iraq. You know, the death count, they had a thing on, I think it was CNN today, about the suicides. It's just amazing. They come back messed up, and there's no room for them in none of these hospitals. There's no programs to deal with it, and these people are taking their lives right and left. I mean, that's going to be a very, very, very big thing.
Yeah, I mean, there is a high suicide rate, but it's not like a huge number. What is really, actually, Roger, an interesting point, I mean, as I said earlier, I have on my website that I take from CNN, the number of our soldiers that were killed in Iraq, and I'm trying to remember the number, it's like 1,781 now. But what about the people that die after they leave the field of battle?
Oh, it's just like the injuries are up. People are maimed, are up to over 50,000 with lost limbs. And what they do, they don't want them no more. They throw them right out, have nothing to do with them. Here, you fend for yourself.
Yeah, well, hopefully they're going to be doing something more. Also, I don't think it's 50,000. But thank you, Roger. I appreciate it. In fact, let's see here. Christopher wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He suffered rumors. I've come across rumors on websites suggesting an underreporting of U.S. deaths as a result of the war. The rumors say that once a soldier is evacuated out of Iraq, if the latter end up dying, they are not listed among the death toll that is reported. Certainly, some of the soldiers were injured severely enough to die, but not right away. With over 10,000 injured, if only 5% of those injured died later from their wounds or complications, that would still mean another 500 or 600 more deaths. And this, from Stars and Stripes, Landstuhl, this is the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center, recently surpassed a hallmark number in its treatment of patients injured in Operations Iraqi and Enduring Freedom. Combination of more than 25,000 troops, civilians, and coalition members from 37 countries involved in the global war on terrorism have received treatment at Landstuhl. So, let me see. They treated their first patient for this war on terror in fall 2001 and reached the 25,000 patient mark this July 4th. Well, those figures don't entirely add up, do they? Now, this note, too, we were talking earlier about recruitment, trying to get poor people from Guam and Saipan and places like that. The Defense Department quietly asked Congress on July 19th to raise the maximum age for military recruits to 42 for all branches of the service. Maybe they could reduce it, too, to like 15 or something like that. What do you think? Here's Jim in Detroit. Jim, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Let's go back to the economy for a second. During this whole conversation I've been listening to, not once did I hear any comment made about the oil situation as it exists today. I've tried to talk to you about this before, and I'm not making much progress, I'm afraid. There are responsible people who are saying that the American economy, because of our dependence on non-renewable forms of energy, is teetering on the brink of collapse. And Michael Rupert from the Wilderness and the author of Crossing the Rubicon, the book, by the way, in which he names Dick Cheney as the architect of the 9/11 attack, suggests that our economy will teeter and collapse toward the end of the year. His litmus he's citing is natural gas supplies. What? Matthew Simmons, the energy investment banker, no tree hugger he, has just recently released his book called Twilight in the Desert, which is a study of the Saudi Arabian oil fields. And in that book, he demonstrates fairly clearly that Saudi Arabia is teetering on the brink of peak oil if it has not already arrived there. And
For one thing, I mean, I think that Rupert, I mean, I'm familiar with him. I think that a lot of his contentions are off the wall. Remember, Jim, you said on this program on July 31st that the economy of the United States is going to collapse by the end of the year. So 6 months, remember that. It's not like writing it down, but we'll both try to remember it. Unless there is a major terrorist attack again in the United States, I don't think that's going to happen. In terms of peak oil production, Most responsible observers or analysts in that field agree that we are soon going to reach peak oil production. The United States pumps a lot of oil out, but we're way beyond our peak oil. So it doesn't mean that there isn't going to be any. It means that we're starting to go on the downside of the available supply. Now, it's clear as the world economy grows and there's more and more of a demand for, as you said, fossil fuel usage, that control of oil, and this is why the war in Iraq is being fought, ultimately. I mean, all the other things, lots of other things, but ultimately it's about oil, I mean, in all of its different aspects, including what it's paid for it. But this is very serious, and I don't know why you say you haven't gotten anywhere with me. I mean, that as long as we're locked into an oil economy, and oil destroys the environment at every during every phase of its existence, and that the United States has spent trillions over the last 50 or 60 years to ensure that we have a supply of a continuing supply of it, and that's what's happening in Iraq today. Rather than understanding that there has to be, if we could build an atomic bomb in a matter of a year, that we ought to be able to develop alternative sources to fuel, that we wouldn't need to fight a war in Iraq, we wouldn't have to be friends with awful dictatorships like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the rest of these terrible countries like that. So you are getting somewhere, because I was there already.
Hello?
Hello.
Are we still there?
What do you mean, are we still there? Of course we're still there.
I'm not hearing too well. I just would like to point out a couple of numbers to your listening audience regarding this energy situation. Every time somebody fills their gas tank with fuel in this country, 30% of it comes from our country, 70% of it comes from foreign sources of oil. Those sources of oil oftentimes are countries which are hostile to our interests. Imagine what life will be like in this country when those 70% of our oil reserves dry up. We have approximately 15 days of oil in storage in this country to carry on our daily activities. There is no plan B. Natural gas supplies, by a lot of responsible people's estimates, are teetering on the brink of collapse in North America. Most people don't know, for example, that up until 2003, Canada was delivering approximately 17% of the natural gas that this country consumes, and that importation has stopped, and it will never continue again. Natural gas does not gradually disappear. It hits a cliff and then goes away entirely. And Matthew Simmons has been talking about this for the last couple of years, and really nobody's paying attention to it.
Well, I think it is beginning to get an audience. That's why, I mean, I would separate yourself from somebody like Rupert, that on one hand he says things that are spot on, but then he throws into it that Cheney's responsible for 9/11. Well, I mean, if he is, and I've seen enough of this and enough people believe it, but there's enough that's right out there in the open that's verifiable, like the fact that we are approaching a world point of world peak oil production. And as the technological economies of Asia expands, it makes common sense. We get less and less fuel, more and more gizmos that need it. We're going to hit the wall. I agree with you. Jim, you're our last caller. Thank you very much. I'm sorry to those of you who have left stranded on the line, but hey, the clock on the wall. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Musky fishermen, get ready to compete for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway. There's still time to enter to win cash and prizes if you can boat the biggest fish on September 17th. Sign up now for the Musky Championship. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in today. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team
in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Hooters, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, professional grade caulk, sealants, and adhesives. Complete battery source, every battery for every need, and 101 WRIF.
Hello?
What are you doing way down there?
I'm personally demonstrating how low the rates really are at American Equity Mortgage.
Sounds pretty low.
4.8% low.
What?
4.8% fixed rate.
What?
Hang on. I said fixed rate. Call American Equity Mortgage today at 888-229-7699 and get an incredibly low 4.8% on a fixed-rate loan.
That rate would really lower my payments.
You can pay off those high-interest credit cards and save hundreds of dollars every month with perfect or less than perfect credit.
4.8% is a great rate. That's American Equity Mortgage?
American Equity Mortgage. Just call 888-229-7699. Call toll-free 888-229-7699 or apply online at AmericanEquity.com. APR 5.525%. Rate subject to change.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Dear Mr. Vice President of Keeping Track of Where I Am, see, there's this thing where people get together at the end of the day. We meet at the bar downstairs for the bright, crisp, clean taste of Budweiser. Then we laugh at all things corporate. Come on down. It's gonna be a good time.
I watch the clock, alright, it's a countdown. My work is done and my friends are coming round.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-824-6692. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-824-6692. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now. 1-800-824-6692. That's 1-800-824-6692.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. If you've listened closely over the years or been listening for a number of years, you know I'm a longtime member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFL-CIO. So I have a real interest in the conference of my parent union or the overall structure which my parent union is a member of, the AFL-CIO. It just had a historic 50th anniversary meeting in Chicago from Monday through Thursday. And at that, President John Sweeney was reelected to a fourth term, but there's a lot more at issue. Joining me is David Bacon, and David Bacon is a reporter specializing in labor issues. He's been on this show before. His most recent article is Reconnecting Labor with Its Radical Roots, and that's available at truthout.org. If you go to my website, peterwerby.com, there's a link to truthout.org, very important site for figuring out what's going on. David Bacon's on the road. Thanks for joining us on such short notice, David.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Peter.
Yeah, now, it's interesting. I'm always interested in words and reconnecting labor with its radical roots. And some of the quotes that I see you say talk about radical demands. Well, the word radical as an adjective is kind of has a lot of baggage with it these days. We always talk about radical Islamists and all of that. How do you use the term? I mean, in what it's often suggests extremism. What's your sense of radical demands and radical roots?
Well, maybe I'm just a 60s kind of guy, but I think to me radical means really substantial change, not tinkering around the edges. And so connecting labor with its radical roots, what I mean by that is, you know, there were times in the history of our labor movement in this country, for any of your listeners that remember their labor history a little bit or have read about it, the time of the Wobblies or the industrial workers of the world around after the turn of the century, or the time when our modern unions were really built and grew very quickly during the 1930s, the CIO, when unions proposed what we would consider radical solutions to social problems. Let's take one as an example, national health care.
Sure.
And we're the only industrial country in the world that doesn't have national health care. And when you start talking about it in Washington, people practically accuse you of being a Red. And yet, this is a basic necessity for people in this country because we have so many people without health insurance at all. And plus, when you look at the fights that unions have had over the last decade, most of them have been about who is going to pay the insanely rising costs of health care premiums, whether it's going to be employers or workers. So just as the cause of strikes, look at what happened. That was the cause of the big grocery strike in Southern California, for instance, was who was going to pay the cost of that. So that's one, or another one is...
Wait. That does not sound like a radical demand to me. So behind the curve in terms of what constitutes modern society, that seems like, hey, can we bring the United States into the modern era with a national health program? So, okay, I'm discounting that, David Bacon, as a radical demand.
All right. Well, I think that what makes it radical also is not just looking at it by itself, but that we think about what a just society would look like. You know, what is our vision that we're for? Especially in the labor movement, we talk a lot about what we're against and all the problems that we are having because of the fact that large corporations in this country, for instance, are attacking unions right and left. We have an administration that's very hostile. We have a big war going on. So all of these problems, and we don't talk very much about what it is that we want, what's our vision of what a just society would look like, and therefore, how can we build a social movement that's going to get us there, that includes unions, but that's more than just unions, that includes, you know, or community organizations, especially in communities of color, that includes women's organizations, environmentalist organizations, so that we all sort of have in front of us this idea of what how we want people to be treated, what we want our lives to be like. So you could look at a national health care, for instance, as just being a way of achieving something that might sound radical, and that is that health care is a right. It's not a privilege. It's not a commodity for people to make money off of. It's a right that we have as human beings. The same thing about jobs. Now, maybe this one is a radical demand. I don't know. You tell me, Peter. But
I'm the radical-o-meter.
I think that people in this country have a right to a job, a right to it. It's not a privilege. It's not something that employers should be able to take away at their whim. People have the right to work because we all need to work in order to be able to live. And we also have a right to the job that we have. In other words, you know, I don't see that there's some divine right that a corporation has to close a factory and to send the work somewhere else simply because they want lower wages. Mm-hmm. That we, as the working people in our workplaces, we have the right to the jobs that we have.
How about this? So, we could use this language. I think this is a radical reform. Actually, both of them are. Traditionally, the labor movement, beginning, for instance, with the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, as they were called, they wanted to abolish the wage system. They wanted to replace the the government that exists now with what they called one big union that would administer things through workers' councils. That's fundamentally radical. But I think what you're suggesting, that I think that we've seen from the polls, that most people support the kind of reforms, even if they are radical, that is extreme from what we have today, because they do, as you're indicating, take into account the basic necessities of life in any modern society. So can we?
Well, I would go even one step further than that one, Peter, and I would say that as working people and as the majority of the people in this country, we have the right to change our social system in any way that we want in order to assure that we get those rights. You know, there's nothing that says that, you know, our system here is engraved in stone. You know, we built it. We are entitled to change it if it doesn't suit our interests. So, you know, I think the Wobblies in some ways had a, you know, kind of a nice vision of the future, but one I'm not sure I think is all that realistic. But, you know,
well, you can...
I love the vision, you know, but I also one thing I like about the Wobblies, and that is that they were not about to let their employers tell them the system that they had in place at that time was a divine system that nobody could change.
Yeah, people can, by the way, look at IWW.org. The union is celebrating its centenary this year. Now, let's, I love theorizing, and I think it's important. I don't mean to disparage it, because it's important to get kind of a theoretical foundation of how you want to function out there in reality. But let's go to the Chicago convention of the AFL-CIO that ended on Thursday. And David Bacon, you were there, at least for part of it. Am I correct?
That's right.
And you live out on the West Coast in the Bay Area. What brought you all the way? You're a labor reporter. What was your interest in attending this?
Well, I was interested in all of it, but there was one particular part of it that I thought was really important, that was the fight to get our labor movement to take a position in opposition to the war in Iraq, and to call for the withdrawal of our troops there to bring our sons and daughters home. And that, in fact, did come to the convention on Tuesday. And what took place was, I think, a really good lesson in how unions work and should work, and that is that there is a movement in this country among union members that goes from the bottom to the top, called U.S. Labor Against the War, that started out even before the war in Iraq started, that consisted of people in many, many different unions that wanted to see, you know, well, first tried to prevent the war, and then once it was underway, you know, tried to figure out how to get it to stop. And this movement, I think, has done some remarkable things, among which was it brought six Iraqi trade unionists to the United States this past spring, who came over here and asked unions and workers in this country to do what they could to try and help end the intervention and get the troops home so that Iraqi workers could regain control of their own society and their own country.
Now, they were at the convention, weren't they? At least
yes.
Some representatives of them. By the way, I should say, right. David Bacon, for full disclosure, I'm nominally a member of U.S. Labor Against the War. I say name anomaly because some point or other, as a union member, I signed on. You know, I didn't know you were going to say this. I knew we were going to talk about this, but I thought when you said you were interested in the resolutions that, of course, there's now the well-known split where the Teamsters and the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, have dropped out of the AFL, creating this first split in 50 years or something like that. And yet the AFL agreed to provide $22 million for organizing efforts to bring more people into the union movement. Why did that not satisfy the Teamsters and the SEIU?
Well, I think because things got so polarized before the convention started. That first of all, the Teamsters and the SEIU were proposing that more money go to organizing. Their proposal was for $50 million. So $22 million did not meet not so much for $50 million, but what they were proposing was that unions who were actively organizing would be rebated 50% of the per capita payments that they make to the National Federation, which would be considerably more than what the Sweeney administration had proposed. So in the press, what this was portrayed as was being a difference between the AFL-CIO that wanted to put the emphasis and the money into political action and elections, and the two unions that dropped out, plus other unions that haven't dropped out yet but that are sort of together with them, who want to put more money and resources into organizing. I think really that this is a bit of a mischaracterization, really, because the truth is that on both sides of this, you have unions that are very actively organizing and very interested in doing it and confronting major, major problems, not all of which are going to be solved simply with money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that workers don't have any legal right to organize in this country is not basically a money problem. You know, what you have is employers who feel free to fire workers and often do in the course of organizing drives. Ordinary workers know that this is the risk that they take in joining a union, and consequently, people are afraid to step out and to do that.
Well, wait a minute now. What about the Wagner Act? I thought that settled all that back in the Roosevelt reforms of the 1930s.
Well, what happened is that the way in which the law is administered has been completely distorted, so that in a way it's been turned inside out and into a contradiction of its former self. As you say, the purpose was to give workers the right to organize and a process by which they could do so easily. What we have now is a legal structure, the National Labor Relations Board, and the body of case law that it administers, which are obstacles and hurdles for workers to overcome in order to organize, a system that's very easy for employers and company lawyers and the anti-union consultants to manipulate, and which has no penalties at all for employers who do things like fire workers because they try and organize a union. And the thing is that workers know this. You know, people aren't dumb. And so, you know, for unions that go and try and initiate organizing drives, that's one of the biggest hurdles to be overcome. So that's a combination of a money problem and a political problem. Hmm. You know, you need to have money to hire organizers. You need to have money to run union campaigns and resources. You also need to have the ability to fight politically against how this law is being turned inside out. You know, Michigan has a wonderful ex-congressman, David Bonnier,
sure,
who was one of the heroes of the fight against NAFTA, who now is the head of an organization called American Rights at Work, which is trying to change U.S. labor law to make it more like the original Wagner Act and also the way in which it's enforced so that we actually do have protections for workers. But that's a political fight, you know. So here you have this combination of money and politics. And so to say that, you know, we need all of, you know, organizing and all money to go into organizing, or all politics and all money to go into politics, I think is oversimplifying the problem. You know, we have big problems on both, you know, in both areas, so to speak, here. So I'm not sure that, you know, speaking personally, I'm not sure that this split was really necessary. I think that there are a lot of reasons why unions still need to work together. And even though we now have two unions that are outside of the AFL-CIO and other unions that refuse to attend the convention as a sort of act of solidarity or a kind of protest against the Sweeney administration policies, now that the convention's over, we're still going to have to work together. I mean, I live in California, Peter. We have a terrible governor, the Terminator, who has organized a special election and put all kinds of really anti-worker, anti-union things on the ballot here. And our labor movement is the linchpin to defeating it and to defeating him. And we're going to have to work together here in California in order to be able to do that, regardless of who's pulled out of the AFL-CIO and who hasn't.
This is the Peter Werby Show, and we are talking to labor reporter David Bacon, who is on the road. He's based in the Bay Area. There could be a lot of people. I always do this. I try to anticipate. I don't know how well I can do it. The questions in listeners' minds. And since the labor movement, what, makes up about 13% of the workforce, I mean, could it be that 87% of our listeners are saying, well, this is kind of interesting, but it doesn't affect me. What do I care? I don't belong in a union. I don't see any movement in my particular job setting towards a union. And so what? I mean, who cares? It seems like just a big fight that doesn't involve me at all.
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples of how it affects everybody. One is what just happened at United Airlines, where United just turned its pension system over to the federal government, to us, the taxpayers. We're going to have to subsidize United Airlines pensions. All the workers at United are getting their pensions slashed, regardless of whether they belong to a union or not. And other big corporations, looking at what United did, are going to start trying to do the same thing, whether or not they have a union, because there are a lot of big corporations out there that still have these what are called defined benefit pension plans, which give workers pension money based on how many years that they've worked at the company. And companies want to dump those and initiate a lot cheaper kinds of pension arrangements or none at all. And so whether or not unions are able to resist that has an influence over the pensions of lots and lots of other people.
Probably, in other words, non-union. I'm sorry, I talked right over you, but I think you were saying the same thing I was. This affects other non-unionized work situations. I mean, these people, they're saying, well, is there any opposition to it? And they kind of look around, and a few people are grumbling, and maybe the unions are officially protesting. But if there's not opposition to this, what we thought is carved in granite, these defined benefit pensions, these companies are saying, hey, why pay them when we don't have to? Definitely. What does it mean that the unions have fallen on such hard times? I mean, people say everything from the attack of the conservative presidencies of Reagan and Bush 1 and 2 up to and including the bureaucratization of many of the unions. They've gotten fat and soft. Let me, before you answer that, you can maybe answer this as part of like a two-part question, as they say. And that is, I worked for the broadcasting division of the United Auto Workers as well, and they went into a number of very big campaigns against foreign automakers that were in Alabama and Tennessee. I know Mercedes, and was it Honda as well? I think, yeah.
There was a Nissan one in Smyrna in Tennessee.
Yeah, right, and a Nissan. And they put everything they could in. I mean, I know people in the organizing department of the UAW. They put their best people in there. They funded it at an incredible level. And yet, what happens is once this starts getting to the campaigning process, it's almost a virtual certainty that the union's going to lose. So, I mean, actually, I don't know if this is a two-part question. It's two separate ones. What's the overall reason for the decline? And it seems that even when unions are working at their best, they seem to lose.
Well, let's take them on sort of in the order that you asked them, Peter. Going back to the pension thing for a second here, these defined benefit pensions were not gifts from employers. These were things that were won by unions and that became so popular that even non-union employers initiated them, partly in order to keep unions from organizing. First of all, the fact that we have them at all is owing to unions. And secondly, the decline in the strength of unions means that we have not been able to defend them successfully, as at United Airlines, when those big companies have said, this is costing us too much money, we're just going to dump them over the side. So what does this mean for unions? It means that unions are not able to fight these things by themselves, that if they try and just fight them by themselves, they lose. So we need, that's what I'm talking about when I say a social movement. We need a movement to do things like to defend those pensions and the right to have a pension and the right to be able to live your old age without going into poverty and eating dog food, that unites unions together with other organizations like the AARP or like seniors organizations or women's organizations or what have you. We need a much bigger movement than unions themselves. And that's part of what this disagreement around organizing is about. You know, some unions are more active in organizing these coalitions than others. Going on to, the what happened at Smyrna, Nissan Smyrna and the Mercedes plant there, partly what happened there, what's happening there, and the fact that, workers vote against the union after all of the resources put into those campaigns, as you're talking about, partly this is a problem of the law, that the law permits these companies to basically scare the living daylights out of workers by saying they're going to close the plant, or they might be forced into going on strike, or they might actually lose money in their wages, things that are essentially intimidation tactics and sometimes fire people, and there's no obvious punishment for the company. So the lesson that that has for most workers is don't cross your boss unless you're really prepared to risk a whole lot. Well, that's, you know, that's a very difficult situation for unions to win in so long as they use that legal process, which comes to the second thing about it I think is important, and that is that using that legal process is not a route to winning organizing drives anymore. That partly for big factories like that, see, what happens is that, you know, for one reason or another, maybe a group of workers approach the union, or the, maybe the union in its internal discussions decides that the time has come for another campaign. So the organizers go down to Smyrna, they get the campaign going, they meet with workers, they circulate cards, they go and visit people at home, and they have the election. The union loses the election, and the organizers go away for a while until, you know, 4 or 5 years go by, and then they do the next one. Unions, I don't think, can really organized that way, and in fact, when you look at how unions got organized in the auto plants back in the 30s, that was not what happened. What actually happened was that workers built some organizations just to defend themselves of the job that, you know, didn't necessarily have contracts or recognition from the employers, but that existed there inside the plant because workers wanted to have them day in and day out. Sometimes they were secret organizations at Ford. Mm-hmm. They were secret because Ford had its own secret police that would go out there and try and find out who was involved and fire them if they could. So some of them, you know, met in secret outside in workers' homes and so forth. But workers had those things that existed there all the time. And so that's another organizing problem that you can't just solve by spending money. You have to actually work with people and have an engagement and an involvement with people on a constant day-to-day, year-in, year-out basis that helps people to change the conditions in the plant, whether or not you've got a union election on the horizon.
Or,
so I think again, is part of what people are talking about.
And these days, not just the plant, but the service sure. industries and wherever people work. Now, I've seen polls that always say over 50% of non-union workers would like to have a union. Why it's not 100% is way beyond me, because we know the statistics, better wages, better health care, better retirement, everything that you experience on a job. Unionized workers, including myself, have it way above the non-union people. But I guess that said, and looking at the clock, David Bacon, with about a minute and 40 seconds left, a question I often ask, are you hopeful? I'm not tremendously hopeful, to tell you the truth, but how do you feel?
Oh, I'm an optimist, Peter.
That's good.
I believe that, you know, first of all, I think that working people want something better, and I think we're going to find ways of fighting for it, regardless of what the obstacles are that are thrown in front of us. So that's part of what makes me optimistic. You know, I worked in non-union plants. I worked in the electronics industry in Silicon Valley. I know what that's like. But I also know that people just try that. You know, we love our families. We want our kids to have something better than what we have. You know, we have a basic fundamental belief in democratic values, and we're willing to fight for them. So partly I have a faith in people. But I also think that, you know, that shaking up the labor movement in some ways is not a bad thing right now, because as difficult as these divisions are, I think that we also can't go on just doing what we have been doing. In fact, I would say that on both sides, unions agree with that. That we can't go on doing what we have been doing, that it's not working. Now, what the solution is, that's what we need to be debating. And I think that so far, the debate has been kind of shallow. We need a much deeper debate over what the answers to these questions are.
Well, thank you, David Bacon. David Bacon is a labor reporter. His most recent article is Reconnecting Labor with Its Radical Roots. It's available at truthout.org. It'll also be on my website, peterwerbe.com. Last name is W-E-R-B-E. So it's peterwerbe.com. You can also go to dbacon.igc.org for some great photos of working class activity. David Bacon, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
It was my pleasure, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
Erotic image.
Add a stripper to any party and watch your party come alive.
Erotic Image Strippers delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image Strippers at 888-41-STRIP.
Explore Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of the Erotic Image Dream Girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty, awesome twosomes, the wild, girly girls. Turn your party into a bash and try a party appetizer to kick off your next gathering. Their costumed host, hostess, and bartenders will cater to your guest of honor and dazzle your party. Now at Erotic Image, male and female models for any and all events.
Call, click, or visit the Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View Erotic Image's strippers, check their prices, and place your order online.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, your image is everything.
Time for this year's fantasy draft. Dial her up.
We don't have to dial up anymore.
Why?
I canceled my slow feature-less dial-up and ordered the fast feature-full Comcast high-speed internet. 3, 2, 1, blast off!
What's with the rocket sounds?
Well, because my Comcast.net homepage is a high-speed launching pad to explore the most amazing online content.
Get to the site.
We have now reached speed up to 70 times faster than dial-up.
Stop it.
Comcast.net, your launching pad to cyberspace and beyond, because it's loaded with great features like photo show, video mail, and the fan included free exclusively with service. No wonder more people across America choose Comcast high-speed internet.
Right now, get Comcast high-speed internet for $29.99 a month for 12 months. Call 1-888-COMCAST today.
Limited time offer. Rates and availability of promotion may vary for non-Comcast cable customers. After promotional period, regular monthly service and equipment charges apply. Restrictions and fees may apply. Call for pricing and details. Speed comparisons are based on Comcast maximum download speed of 4.0 megabits per second versus standard dial-up packages maximum download speed of 56 kilobits per second. Actual speeds may vary and are not guaranteed.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-824-6692. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-824-6692. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now. 1-800-824-6692. That's 1-800-824-6692.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. What a pleasure to be with you, and a pleasure to bring an old friend and a man who has done so much for the Detroit community. It's Ishmael Ahmed, and he's director of the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services. I stumbled over that better and best said as access. Ishmael Ahmed, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for inviting me.
And you were kind enough to give me a tour of the brand new Arab American National Museum here in Dearborn, and it had its grand opening at the first part of May. In fact, it was 5505, wasn't it?
Yeah, catchy, isn't it?
Very catchy. And I don't know what I expected at the museum, but wow, what a place. And I want to just congratulate you and all of the people that made that happen. But I wonder if people listening think, well, Arab American National Museum, if they are Arab American, and what, we have about 500,000 people in Michigan of Middle Eastern ancestry, they might say, oh, well, that's good. But probably the majority of people saying, well, that's for, quote, them. Who's it for?
It's actually for pretty much everyone. It targets young people in particular. Kind of the text is 6th to 8th grade. But it's very interactive, and it's full of surprises, things that you might not know about not only Arab Americans, but just life itself.
Mm-hmm. Why a museum for Arab Americans?
Well, first of all, there are 15,000 museums in the United States. I'll bet you didn't know there were that many.
No, I'm surprised indeed.
And until now, there really has not been a single museum that provides information about the presence and the accomplishments and just the lives of Arabs who live in this country, Arab Americans.
Well, very frequently, I would think that the image of Arab Americans or people of Middle Eastern descent would be most of these people have come over here very recently, are not very well integrated into American life, and yet you, in fact, maybe you could even relate a little of your family story. I even had your, I guessed it when your family had come over, and I was wrong by about 20 years too late, right?
Well, actually, it depends on what part of my family. My dad came over as an Egyptian immigrant at 10 years old. He actually left Egypt because his family did not have food on the farm he lived on. And he came here as a undocumented immigrant and then became a citizen during World War II. But on my mother's side, they homesteaded in South Dakota in 1860, and they're Lebanese. So even on my own family tree, there's a whole history out there that's kind of interesting.
Do you, how do you feel? I know that sometimes, particularly given a lot of the recent developments and recent prejudices, that people will almost get that why don't you go back where you belong thing. And here, certainly on your mother's side, your family's been here a lot longer than a lot of European immigrants.
Oh, I love it when people tell me that. I've actually been told that. And I was born in Brooklyn, New York, so I said, to Brooklyn?
Well, there's a lot of social political questions, particularly with current events, but let's stay for quite a while in the Arab American National Museum. And I knew that if you had your hand in it, it was going to be good, but it went
Thanks.
Way beyond my expectations in terms of overall quality of construction, the design of it, and the presentation of the exhibits that show Arab and Arab American life. I don't know, give us somewhat of a tour. I know that could probably take all of our show, but maybe some of your favorites, and I maybe can jump in at some point and tell what I was impressed with as well during my tour.
Sure. Well, it's a small museum, about 4,000 square feet, and it really is kind of a work of art. It has, as you enter, a fountain in the middle of a big courtyard, not unlike the Syrian fountains of old, and it has a dome. You can look up three floors with calligraphy on the ceiling and Moroccan tiles surrounding it. And it has, at the first level, a section that really spends a lot of time on the contributions of the Arab world. So it, in art and history and mathematics and so forth. But also some modern examples of Arab contributions. For instance, there is the seven-star hotel that is in Dubai that looks like a sailboat with amazing little lights on it and so forth. There is a astrolabe there that you can play with and chart the stars yourself. There's even kind of a concentration game, if you've ever played the game Concentration, that allows you to compare Swahili, Arabic, and English, and see the Arabic root of words within the game.
You're being very kind to not tell people that playing Concentration, I totally was a flop at it. I mean,
but it was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Ishmael Ahmed is my guest, the director of Access, and Access is the group behind putting together the Arab American National Museum. And, the American side of everybody always wants to know, how much did it cost? And so well, go ahead. That's too impolite.
It did not cost a lot of money by museum standards, but if you're a community organization building a museum, it's quite a bit. It was $16 million.
I actually asked you that, not just to be an impolite, typical American, but rather to show the kind of community and also corporate support that the museum has gotten. And certainly there was a lot of big grants from some of the auto companies and banks and what have you.
Sure.
But you have a wall in which individual donors were there. And maybe you could speak about that and how it resonated with the people.
Well, we got about 1,500 donations from people in the range of about $500 or more. And these were just people who we don't know. We sent them out a note saying, we're building this museum. Would you be interested in being involved? And they sent us checks from all over the country. So I think there's a real thirst out there for something like this, you know. And I also feel that I'm proud that that it wasn't all Arab Americans by any stretch of the imagination. It was people who are teachers and people who know Arab Americans and people who just thought it was important to have something that explained Arab culture and Arab Americans in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard it said among ethnic groups, for instance, Jewish Americans said the only people that know who other Jews are or who is Jewish in public life are other Jews and people that dislike Jews. Is the same? I mean, to some extent, I was thinking that because there was this list of prominent Arab Americans, and I kept thinking, oh, I didn't know they were from an Arab background. I didn't know they were from an Arab background.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. The term Arab is a cultural term. It's not a racial term or not even in some ways an ethnic term. So Arabs come from 22 different countries, mainly in Africa and Asia Minor, but they're not considered African or Asian here. So, and they've also gone through a lot of different status positionings. They were listed as African at one point, Turkish, Asian, Syrian. And that didn't matter what country you came from in the Arab world. And today they're listed as white. So you can't tell by color. Many Arab Americans, their name seems not Arab American. And so there are a whole bunch of people that are in the museum that you might be surprised. Now, just to give you a few, Casey Kasem, the radio disc jockey or commentator. Another one is Dr. DeBakey, who invented the artificial heart. George Dumani, who invented the theory of continental drift. Senator Mitchell, who was the head of the U.S. Senate. And many, many, many more. One of the things about the museum is we even have a section called Did You Know? And
right.
You discover that four Arab Americans vie over who invented the ice cream cone, and all four of them say, I did. And so we tell each of their stories. Or the White House Santa Claus for seven presidencies was an Arab American, and that's kind of a little bit of a surprise. And I can just, Nick Cicely, the basketball star, Paul Anka, who wrote My Way and New York, New York, they're all Arab Americans.
And what struck me, too, was the willingness of, F. Murray Abraham to donate his award for what?
The Golden Globe. Got a Golden Globe for Amadeus. He was kind of the bad guy in Amadeus, and he gave us his Golden Globe. But we have Jamie Farr, who played Klinger on MASH, who gave us a set of his fatigues and his farewell script to MASH.
Bobby Raynal.
Yeah, yeah.
His racing helmet? And
right. Bobby Rahal, the race driver, gave us his helmet and his uniform. Nick Cicely's gym shoes, which must be 18s or something. They're the biggest gym shoes I ever saw. And many, many others.
You know what strikes me, and first off, we were talking about this before the show, we said part of it is we wanted to communicate the fun and the interesting stuff of this and not concentrate on so much now where you see Arabic names or Muslim names in the paper and they're all associated with pretty negative stuff. And
Arab is equivalent to evil right now in newspapers.
And I mean, hopefully everyone is smart enough not to blame people that had absolutely nothing to do with this. Someone we know, and I shouldn't say his name on there one time, during the Gulf War, he started getting chased by some people. I don't know if you know this story. He's and they were yelling, you know, Arab insults at him. And he said, "Hey, I'm Italian, I'm Italian," and he is. And he started, like, talking in Italian, which convinced them that he was an Arab.
Yeah, it's not really funny. It's a sad state of affairs. You know, actually, the first person killed after September 11th was a Sikh, because he had a turban, you know, and he looked dark. People thought he was Arab, and so murdered him. So, you know, it's not really... This image is being created out there of Arabs, and I imagine there are, in fact, we know there are images of other people as well of color that really don't match the real world. And regular people who work hard and, you know, try to live and raise their families often are victims for no good reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was touring the Arab American National Museum last Tuesday, I think I had just heard this Robert Siegel on All Things Considered, the NPR show. He was hammering at a British Muslim, a representative of the Muslim community there, to denounce terrorism, and he wasn't getting enough. And I just thought how insulting this would. It would be like if all of a sudden I started being interviewed and someone started saying, Peter, will you denounce Timothy McVeigh? You know, will you denounce, what was that guy that was eating everybody, you know? Why do people feel that there's a much deeper connection between some people doing some very terrible things in Britain and you here in Detroit, whereas I don't get connected up with all the white evil people?
Well, I think there is a long history of imaging and stereotyping and Orientalism that really have developed these images over a long period of time. Some of it was just kind of people who didn't do their homework, and later it was just racism and colonialism. I know those are words people don't use anymore, but that's really what went on. And these images of people have developed. Here in the United States since 1967, you know, our government has pretty much sided kind of with one side of the Middle East conflict. And so we began to see these images that really were war images, not unlike the Japanese or, you know, the Italians in early days and many, many others. One of the things the museum tries to do in a fun kind of way, and I know this is, it's strange to say in a fun kind of way, is it captures a lot of things that have happened to other people that you can see yourself or see some of these groups in the images of Arab Americans. A good example.
Explain this. I haven't...
For instance, there's a section on the Asian Exclusion Act.
Okay.
And it shows what happened to Asians, but because at that time Arabs were Asian, were described as Asian at the same time, they suffered the same kind of effects. So Asians couldn't own property or become citizens in the early 1900s and late 1800s, and then were excluded from coming to the United States. Well, Arab Americans went through the same things. And we also draw some other parallels with the Latin community and African Americans. One of the interesting things in the museum is it notes that the first Arab to come to the United States and probably also the first African American were the same person. It was a Moroccan who was a slave who was kidnapped by the Portuguese and brought to America on an exploratory tour. He ended up leading the expedition because he knew a lot about health and languages, and the Native Americans liked him.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was in, what, the 16th century?
It was 1511, I believe.
Oh. Ismail Ahmed is my guest. He's the director of ACCESS, the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, and they have an extraordinary range of programs, and we probably should spend just in a little while getting you to acquainted with what they offer. One of the things they offer that probably is outside directly of the Dearborn community is the Concert of Colors, a annual, what was this, the 13th anniversary?
Yeah, it was Lucky 13.
Lucky 13, where the music and the culture of the entire ethnic and color rainbow are brought together in July for the most extraordinary free concert you're ever going to hear. And I know some of you, because I see some of you there, and if you're missing that, don't miss it next year. Also, ACCESS has put together the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. And, you know, people always, as you know about radio listening patterns, being a broadcaster yourself, that people don't necessarily listen to the whole show. So maybe we ought to give them some information about exactly how to find the Arab American National Museum and all the kind of the particulars. I'll have it on my website, peterwerby.com. But and let me tell you, I went there. I had a personal tour from our guests, and at the end, I thought, you know, I better come back here with my wife and some friends, because I didn't even take in the whole thing. But go ahead. How do we get a hold of the venue?
Well, first of all, it's located on Michigan Avenue, right across the street from the Dearborn City Hall, which is interesting in and of itself. And the phone number there is 313-582-AANM. Give it to you one more time. It's 582-AANM, Arab American National Museum. And it's open on Wednesdays through Sunday, pretty much, from 10 to 6. And on Thursday, we're open late. And in addition to the museum itself, there is a whole bunch of programming going on there for kids. This week they were doing a whole thing on henna artwork, teaching young kids to do henna designs and also to do Egyptian plaques. They made their own little plaques, scarab plaques. And in the fall, starting in mid-September, we are going to be programming every evening music from all over the world.
Every evening?
Every Thursday evening. Thank you.
Because I was going to say, I know what I'm going to be doing on my Thursday evenings as we discuss this, but tell us.
Well, what we've agreed to do there is to provide about a quarter of the programming will be Arabic performers from all over the world, but the rest will be performers from everywhere else. I know that we are talking to the Bulgarian bebop choir. And
I'm there.
We're talking to Amadou and Miriam, who are blues musicians from Mali, and also a few Americans, too, so out of Detroit. So what we're trying to do is show people that there is a world of music, amazing music that you may not know about. And it's a chance kind of to, somebody put it this way, kind of get a musical dim sum.
I like that. Let me see. Oh, we've got about 5 minutes remaining. So let's talk a little about ACCESS, the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services. I always think of ACCESS doing a lot of good things, but I was surprised that of the scope of it all.
ACCESS is about 35 years old, and we started out helping new immigrants, but we pretty much help out people of all backgrounds now. We're located all over Detroit metropolitan area. We even have people that we work with in different communities in about 15 other cities now. And we do all kinds of things. We have clinics that provide health care irregardless of the ability to pay. We have food and shelter programs, English classes. But We also have a lot of arts and culture and other activity. We believe that we're all whole human beings, and so we try to address employment problems. We probably place about 4,000 people a year in jobs. We have mental health programs. We even have a victims of torture center, a center that helps hundreds of people who have been tortured in other countries and who need help here today.
AIDS work as well?
Oh, yeah. We have a big AIDS outreach program as well as testing not only for AIDS but for cancer, breast and cervical cancer. Most of these programs, by the way, are free or a few of them at very small cost. For instance, we're the largest provider of immigration services in the state. And that we do charge a little bit of money for. We translate documents for people. I can go on with about 70 programs.
Tell me, you know, this is an unusual vision. Usually people that are rooted in one ethnic group stay in terms of serving that particular group. And usually groups that need service, that's quite an undertaking itself. What's in the vision of Access that has extended it, as I said earlier, to kind of the whole rainbow of people that make up our Detroit region?
I think we really believe that we're all human beings. I know that seems trite, but we really do believe that, and that that we're all in need of decent lives and a shot at the future. And so it doesn't really matter to us what somebody's ethnic background is. It's a plus that they bring that to the table, but that's not what providing service should be about. So our staff and our board and the community that we serve all reflect Detroit.
Mm-hmm. So the services then are available to anybody regardless of ethnic background or race or creed or what do they say, national origin?
Oh, sure. We wouldn't want it any other way.
Well, that's certainly, I think I told you this on one show I do. I mentioned that when you were kind of asking for a cheer from the crowd, from the different parts of the rainbow at the Concert of Colors, and I said, you know, that is what not only our community is about here, but the world is about. And if anybody that has a narrow vision, they're probably just adding to the problem rather than creating the solution, which is a recognition that, again, without sounding trite, we're all here in the same place, and we better get along.
Yeah, I think one of the things we always end the concert with is we say to people, remember that you're all brothers and sisters. Take care of each other.
No, that's great. And you and Access, Ishmael Ahmed, do a wonderful job. You can find Access under the directory. You can call there for services. The Arab American National Museum is a gem waiting there to be viewed and taken in. I'm going back there again. Thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Another WRIF concert.
America's favorite rock band is back.
You love me, but you don't.
Bud Light presents Three Doors Down. Headlining an all-star summer concert with Staind. Breaking Benjamin. And Noah Dress. Tomorrow night at DTE Energy Music Theater. Three Doors Down with Staind, Breaking Benjamin, and Noah Dress. Tickets are available now on SamWithPalaceNet.com, the Palace and DTE Energy Music Theater box offices and Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666. Tomorrow night at DTE Energy Music Theater. Three Doors Down with Staind, Breaking Benjamin, and Noah Dress. The rock ticket of the summer.
Okay. So how do you want to spend your summer? Listening to some stuffy professor droning on and on about the fall of the Roman Empire? Right. Hey, this is Screaming Scott Randall from 101 WRIF. I love going to work every day. A lot of that is because of my time at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. It's the place to start. Specs Howard teaches you everything you need to get started in radio, television, audio and video production, and so much more. Get hands-on experience. Spend a morning behind the microphone, spinning music, and hosting your own show. Design a lighting set for your class talk show. Write a script. Run a camera. Learn to edit. Direct a program. Just tour the school, and you'll see that a career in broadcasting is never dull, and neither will your time be at Specs Howard. Call them at 248-358-9000 from now through August 31st. Check out the school and all they have to offer to begin a career that you can be excited about. Classes are forming now. Morning, afternoon, and evening options are available. The Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield, Michigan. 248-358-9000. This is where you start. It's where I started.
I'm really behind on my bills. I do own my home, but my credit isn't exactly perfect.
Those high-interest credit cards are ruining me. Is there anything I can do to get out of debt?
We need that loan now. Are we ever going to get our cash?
Tired of playing games? Call American Equity Mortgage at 888-229-7699 for the right answer. Yes.
American Equity Mortgage said yes. Even with less than perfect credit, I got the cash I needed.
American Equity Mortgage said yes. I'm saving hundreds of dollars every month.
American Equity Mortgage said yes. We closed in 1 week.
Say yes to a loan from American Equity Mortgage, and we'll say yes to you. Call toll-free, 888-229-7699.
American Equity Mortgage, the future belongs to you.
American Equity Mortgage, open till 8, 888-229-7699, or apply online at americanequity.com.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer before they hit it big. Motor City Riff, every Sunday night at 10. It's loud, it's local, and no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101 WRIF, Riff Rock.
Yeah.
101 WRIF Detroit.